again that would assist both parties in terms of sharpening us going forward. We have a meeting on the 8th of February where we will start with the real business of bargaining, fighting, and that type of thing. Today really it's just about further sharpening our understanding. But from the 8th of February and the next day, we hopefully will be able to go through the bill and reach finality on all the clauses that are there. So we will allow the department. We've scheduled the whole day, basically. But between my boss, Cindy, and I, we don't think we require the whole day. We really don't. But if you guys want to do the whole day, it's fine. Depending on your response, we will not restrict you. But ideally, the sooner we finish, the better. We can carry on until after lunch. We don't have a problem. But we are in your hands. So we will allow you, National Commission and Loretz, to do whatever you want to do. We've asked members to take notes, so in whatever fashion you guys want to respond, you will. We will then open it up to members to then tackle areas that they think you didn't respond to adequately or that you might have overlooked from their side, and we will deal with it in that fashion. So that hopefully by the end of this session, all of us would have covered everything that we'd want to have covered as an initial attempt, and then from the 8th we will then do it in terms of trying to finalize it. So that's how we're going to proceed. The second thing that I want to raise is that you'd recall that on Tuesday, the very last presentation from the prosecution's team, Mr. Bradley, or Advocate Bradley Smith, worried us tremendously in that our understanding was that they were co-authors, so to say, being members of the cluster, and yet their presentation was almost contradictory to what DCS had presented, and we'd asked you to go back and to come back with a response to us in terms of why that is the case. We received a call this morning from Mr. Advocate Smith saying that, one, he wants to apologize, they will be a few minutes late. They were boarding at 9, so they'd be here around about 12. But just to let us know that they are withdrawing that input totally. So the input from the prosecution team is being withdrawn totally. We have indicated to him, and we did share it now with DCS, that be that as it may, when they arrive, we'd want them to repeat what they've said to us telephonically so that we have it on record, that they are withdrawing their presentation totally. But, Commissioner, if you guys want to touch on some of those areas, feel free to touch on them. But I just thought I should indicate that Advocate Smith and his colleagues' presentation, as a presentation from the prosecution, has been withdrawn totally. But there might be points that they raised that are valid that we'd want to tease out, both from this side and from that side. I don't think we should stop it because it's all in the attempt of, as we said earlier on, improving the bill. But for the record, that presentation has been withdrawn in toto, and they'll repeat it when they arrive at 12 o'clock. Having said that, I'm not sure, National Commissioner, how you're going to deal with it, but it's over to you yourself. So before that, let's take Mam Nyanda and Gwenya.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I wanted to show you that you can see that members are not present as supposed to be, and we are going to have a challenge of time. I'm worried about that because I must be in the meeting of the week at 11:45, and some of the members are going to leave at 11 because of this false disaster. Mamnyanda Shinjake is affected. by this disaster involved. Oh, Mama Bly also, she's going to leave early. So I would like us to agree with her, Chair. Thank you.
The legal people are here. They're not. Parliamentary legal people are here? They are. My understanding is, I understand what you're saying, Mam Nyanda. Mam Grenya, beg your pardon. My understanding is that because we are purely engaging in what is before us and there are no decisions that are going to be taken, there is no need for a quorum, for starters. There's no need for a quorum because there are no decisions taken, it's engagement and so on. whatever you miss out as members, you'll have to find a way of catching up, either through Cindy's notes or however, but I do think that we should proceed as far as we can proceed. We've got the department here. We'd be the last one that would want to say they've come down here and then we send them back after an hour and be accused of whatever. So I think we'll continue. I'm sure Mr. Max and I at least would be here and others that would join us, but I think we'll continue. And you'll find a way of filling yourselves in. Remember, this is just a session of getting to understand, but before the actual clause by clause, we'll find a way of bringing everybody on board, if that's okay with members that are going to leave us early. And if that is acceptable legally, we'll proceed. Let's start with the legal guide.
I can confirm, Chair, the position that you articulated is the correct one.
Are we happy? You are free to leave when you want to leave, and we'll catch up. Are you happy with that? You are. Thank you very much. Up over to you, Kishmish.
Chairperson, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, we are sincerely grateful to have this occasion to interact with yourselves. But firstly, it's important that we introduce ourselves. My name is Tom Moyani. I'm the National Commissioner of Correctional Services.
My name is Mike Ramagoma. I'm the Special Advisor to the Minister of Correctional Services.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Lorraine Lowe, the Legal Advisor to the Minister. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen, ladies. I'm Carl Paxton, Director of Code Enforcement in the Department.
I am Lois Ochafta. I am representing the task that worked on the bill and the white paper on corrections.
Good morning, Abalam Damos, my name. I'm Deputy Commissioner, Security and Remand Detention Systems.
Good morning, my name is Terence Razoroka. I'm the Deputy Commissioner in Executive Management in the Office of the National Commissioner.
Good morning. My name is Mamel Lomorodi, Parliamentary Liaison Officer in the Ministry.
Good morning. My name is Becky Manzini. I'm the Director of Cluster and Parliamentary Liaison in the Department.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Frankie Gordon from Portsmouth. I'm Correction Admin Official.
Good morning. My name is Sam Mabocha, Head of Office, Deputy Director's Office.
Deputy Minister's Office. Deputy Minister.
Okay. And to our friends in the media and our stakeholders, I see NICRO, I see CSPRI, and anybody else that I haven't seen, you're very welcome. We also, as we indicated, have parliamentary legal team here. I'm not sure if the state law advisors are here. They're here as well. So from our side, when I say from our side, from parliamentary side, we have those heavyweights on the legal on our side. And everybody else, you are welcome. Over to you, Jim.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I should think it is proper that the ministry, on behalf of the minister and the deputy minister, and the team that I lead, to express our profound condolences on the death of the father to a member of the committee here. We sincerely hope that these condolences will provide solace and support to him as a member of this committee and from the department. Chairperson, I would like to thank all the stakeholders for their valuable submissions on the matter before us. These submissions have generally and specifically served to enhance the contents of this bill. We've taken note and we've taken on board most of these inputs, and we, through our presentation, respond to those that we feel require clarity. Before we go into substantive issues in our presentation, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, I would like firstly to address the specific matters related to the submission of the NPA on Tuesday, which you have alluded us to. We await for their responses so that we get clarity. But may I indicate to yourselves that the introduction of a bill into Parliament was preceded by extensive consultation within the JCPS cluster. This bill was tabled at the JCPS cluster of GDGs on the 11th of October, to which I was the chairperson. And the NPA were party to the discussions that took place. The JCPL DG's meeting unanimously endorsed the bill and the policies contained therein. The bill was then presented to the JCPL's Cabinet Committee, where again the bill was endorsed by all role players upon having received a slideshow presentation on the contents thereof. It is my belief, Chairperson, that my presence today is to reinforce the position that there was a wide consultation process by the Department on the matter before us. Thereafter, the bill was approved by Cabinet for introduction to Parliament at a sitting chaired by the Honourable Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. We would like to indicate to yourselves that extensive consultation has taken place within the cluster. However, this does not mean that all role players agree on all aspects. That is a rare case in this process in which we are involved in. But the lack of agreement by one party does not necessarily mean that this matter was not properly given its due attention. And therefore, equal consensus was looked into, but the importance of the bill is that it was approved in the format in which we are presenting to yourselves. The NPA has in the past in other committees, especially in justice, often submitted comments on various pieces of legislation that are dealt with similarly as those submitted to the public. Especially in this instance, the committee should note that where the NPA made submissions of legal nature, these are either adopted or rejected based on sound reasons. But where individuals within the NPA submitted comments solely relating to policy decisions taken by DS and endorsed by the entire cluster, and where such policy decision would not impact on the operations of the National Prosecuting Agency, are respectfully submitted, but such comments should be noted and be taken on board or rejected. It is therefore submitted that the NPA submission should not be viewed as an impediment to the process of this bill. We're made to understand, as we have discussed, Chairperson, that they will formally withdraw the bill today. We await their presence in this gathering. We're nevertheless still on board. The legally sound inputs made by the NPA were accepted. Insofar as the impact of the public hearings that have been led in this august occasion, the DCF response is as follows. A document was distributed today wherein all submissions made on the bill have been summarized together with DCF responses thereto. In going through these submissions, on a clause-by-clause basis, it will become clear that these inputs from role players and ensuing debates amongst members of the Portfolio Committee have been invaluable in strengthening the bill. Where amendments are proposed as a result of submissions made, these are indicated where DCS holds a different view from that advocated by a submission. Clear reasons are also provided. Finally, Chairperson, from the submissions received, it is clear that there is a support, overwhelming support for the overall policy on a new medical parole system, the repeal of incarceration framework, and the renewed policy focus given to the detention on remand. In order for us to expedite the process of interaction and responding to the issues that were raised with the team, I'll therefore request the chairperson to grant my team to do a clause-by-clause presentation on the issues that are before us. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, if there's no questions to the National Commissioner. For the committee to stay on board with us and for us to take the committee through the bills today and the comments, there would be two documents that need to be in front of each and everybody. One is the summary that we distributed yesterday of the comments and DCA's response, and the other document would be the bill itself for reference. Because the way we've gone about the comments and the response is we've done it clause by clause. So we start with clause one, which deals with definitions, and then we summarize all the inputs by various stakeholders according to clause one, and we address those issues, and then we continue. This will give the committee a good oversight of where we adopt and where we disagree, where we then provide reasons. I will speak to these clauses, but I will be assisted by Mr. Paxton and Mr. Yafta and anybody else from the team that I would rely on to give further detail where necessary. So if everybody's got the documents in front of them, we've also yesterday distributed three pieces of three judgments. Those will only be used on the 8th of February when we go clause by clause, but we've distributed it so long to the committee for information. We've also distributed yesterday to the portfolio committee members specific clauses of the Criminal Procedure Act that we will be referring to, and this morning we've distributed another provision, Section 63A, which we'll also be referring to, so those documents should also be on hand. And then just for the members' information, we've distributed a SAP 127 form, which should also be with the members. This document we have permission to distribute from Paulsmore, but it's on a real inmate, to put it such. It's a live document that's dated now 2011, but it's for purposes when we get to the SAP in further investigation discussion. So we didn't want that document to go too far, but I said to Cindy, each member should at least have one to see the kind of information. When we get to that, we will speak to that. So if everybody is ready.
Just before you carry on, so that everybody understands it, there's a document that says, the one that talks about temporary transfer, is that the one? The one that says temporary transfer? Yeah. This is about a current inmate, and therefore you are asked to deal with it with the necessary sensitivity. Are you with me, Ms. Lai? Yes, ma'am. Mr. Max, you with us? Yeah. No, we will definitely respect that, because that is that is real life or a real situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I could then begin with clause one. A lot of the commentators, you would see repeat, well, there was a lot of repetition of certain arguments, but in clause one, the main argument, well, if we firstly look at the definition of inmate, if we start with the definition of inmate, there were a few commentators who said that the provisions that specifically we refer to in the definition of inmate, where we five specific sections such as 2, 11, 4, and such should be removed, because the definition itself already incorporates wherever you will now see the word inmate in the bill, in the act, you will read in there remand detainee. So it's not necessary to cite specific provisions. And that should be read with section 46.3, which is referred to in, it's in clause 9. It's the section where we said the provisions of section 6 to 24 apply to a remand detainee with such changes as may be required by the context. We're also saying there's no need really for that provision, because in all those provisions, if you go to the Act itself and you look at section 6 to 24, where inmate is referred to, it will include remand detainee now. So it's actually just duplication. We were just actually making doubly sure that it's clear that it's, but it's really unnecessary. So we agree with the CSPRI there, as well as the inspectorate who made the same comment, and we will, when we then present to you clause by clause on the 8th, we will present maybe I should say that up front, a redrafted bill already, where we will indicate the proposals. It won't be like, we were not saying that the committee today accepts our proposals, but it would be an example for you to see how it would look if you should agree with us that we take it out. So we would already present to you such a redrafted bill on the 8th of February. So what we're proposing with the definition of inmate is that it's sufficient just to include remand detention facility and the reference to remand detainees there without reference to the sections, and this should be read within the deletion of section subsection 46.3, where a lot of commentators were especially concerned about the use of the wording within with such changes as required by the context. Again, just to give some background around that terminology, we will come to it again where we want to retain that use of wording for pregnant women. It's to read, if you refer to specific provisions, that our centers look different. Not one of our centers is a blueprint of another center. So sometimes you have to apply these provisions within such changes as required by the context, but it wouldn't be an impediment of the rights, because the moment you take away rights from remand detainees, they will have a right to go to court and demand those. If we're giving, we should treat all remand detainees equal in the country. So it's a matter of interpretation, but in this subsection we will be deleting it, but I will come to... when I come to this section with pregnant women, we will talk to it in more detail. Then there was a second submission on the definition of remand detention facility by the inspectorate. You will see it on page one, the second point there. Here the inspectorate questions whether its mandate has been extended to include police cells or lockups, and specific reference is made in their submission to sections 115 and 117. And it's questioned why is that referred to in the definition, and whether, because those sections are referred to in reference to police cell or lockup, isn't that extending, the question was both, isn't that extending the inspectorate's jurisdiction? Similarly, I just want to first raise all the issues they raised, then I will respond to them. The amendment of Section 5 of the Act by the substitution of Subsection 2 requires clarity of the inspectorate's jurisdiction to monitor police cells. And if you look at Section 5, Subsection 2, all we're doing there is adding in references to remand detention facilities. But I will come to the response now. Inspectorate have finally stated that it seems that its jurisdiction is indeed amended, but the concomitant provisions relating to the inspectorate have not been amended. Now, this commentary should be read together with the other concerns raised by other role players, where they say, well, if we're now on the SAPS provision, where people were questioning shouldn't the inspectorate's jurisdiction be expanded. The DCS is of the opinion that the bill in its current draft format definitely did not intend to, and definitely in actual fact does not extend the jurisdiction of the inspectorate. The inspectorate has never had jurisdiction to inspect police cells, since the investigation of any form of abuse in police custody is the duty of another statutory body, which actually takes its duty from the Constitution, and that is the Independent Complaints Directorate. Now, elsewhere in the comments, I will come to the fact that currently before Parliament, there is actually a bill strengthening the powers of the ICD, and will be called a directorate from now on, and will have much more clear investigative powers, and if they find any signs of criminality, has to be handed over to the MPA. But that is the jurisdiction of another government department, the South African Police Service, and it actually comes from the Constitution. Not even our inspectorate mandate for us comes from the Constitution, but in SAPS, once you're in SAPS custody, whether you're in the van being transported or whether you're in their cells, they must have a body in terms of the Constitution which investigates any forms of torture or death in custody or any complaints raised. So for us, it's a clear distinction of powers between us and SAPS, and their act actually specifically says they, again, when we hand somebody over, they do not have the jurisdiction, the ICD, or even this new directorate to investigate any allegations of torture against our officials. That is a different process within our system. But so for me, it's that clear distinction of there's already a body that has these powers within the SAP system. And then to come to the definition, if we look at the definition itself and the question raised by the inspectorate, where they make a reference to section, if you look at the definition, the only place where we refer to a police cell or lockup in the definition of a remand detention facility, a police cell or lockup as the general run of the mill will never be referred to as a remand detention facility. We're saying this definition is only for the purpose of sections 115 and 117 that includes every place used as a police cell or a lockup. And 115 and 117 deals with escapes. One is aiding an escape and the other one is attempted escape. It creates an offense. So our act only sees a police cell or a lockup as a remand detention facility in terms of the definition, when you deal with those offenses of escaping. So nowhere else when we say use the word remand detention facility, do we see it as a police cell or a lockup? Since that is a different system regulated in terms of the SAPS Act and that the provisions there. And the issue is also that this definition of remand detention facility has word for word been taken from the current definition of a correctional center. So we're just creating, there will also be now facilities which the minister, in terms of Section 3 of the Act, will specifically, she will issue a government gazette where she will say the following facilities will from now on be remand detention facilities. So that's why the definition is exactly the same as the correctional center, because we could have all of these buildings that's listed there, but that's also why the wording in terms of Section 115, 117, and the way we've always viewed police cells and lockups has always been the case, even in terms of the definition of a correctional facility. So there on page 2 where I respond, this is the part where I respond under B, and then C, I just again emphasize the fact that sections 115, 117, specific care has been taken not to define all police cells and lockups as to fall under the definition of a remand detention facility, since such a step would clearly encroach on the jurisdiction of SAP, since all the other provisions of the Act will then apply to another constitutionally established security service. And it's, again, to come back to the Constitution, correctional service is not listed in the chapter of the Constitution, but SAP is specifically. And if we see this definition of remand detention facility so broad that we include all lockups and police cells, all the provisions of the Act will then apply to another department. So we can't read it as broad as that. We have to limit it to the current position, which has always been the case. And then coming to, maybe I should say, if I move too quick, because it's different areas each time, yes, a member must stop me to ask.
I was about to stop you there so that we just clear on that one. In terms of the definition, I think there's clarity around that one. In terms of the facilities, let me give you the layman's understanding, and I think our understanding and everybody else. This bill, if enacted, makes you the custodian even of remand detainees, correct? As correctional services. At some point, your constituency is handed over to SAPS for 7 days, 14 days, because we will get to the extension. So your constituency is transferred to somebody else. Whilst in your care, we all accept that the inspecting judge is the independent somebody that we as public or the committee can go to and say, go and check on so and so. The committee's concern, and I think many of the commentators' concern, was that because now you're asking us to approve a situation where you could hand somebody over for 40 days, 30 days, whatever the case might be, what guarantee do we have? Because it's your constituency, regardless if you're handing him over, it's only a temporary handover. What guarantee do we have that that individual that's in the police custody is treated similarly to somebody that might not be in the police custody and still in your custody? I think that is what we were worried about as the committee, and I think everybody else. If I'm understanding what you're saying now to us, is that once you hand him over to SAPS, your responsibility, when I say your responsibility, I'm saying you, the inspecting judge, everybody else, your mandate, so to say, ends. And any under mandate going beyond that in terms of inhumane treatment now becomes ISD. Is that what you are saying to us? Your understanding is, because we're not going to argue here whether we agree or not, but as long as we understand that this is what DCS is saying, we'll go away on our own and say, this is what DCS is saying. They agree this is what they are saying. We understand them to be saying that. We will then go and argue, develop our argument for you. I just want to make sure that we are understanding this thing so that we don't go and debate on the basis of a false or a inaccurate interpretation. So my interpretation, if they had asked me what it meant, would be this correctional services through this amendment are saying to us that from the time that remand detainee Vincent Smith is transferred to the police, the police and its organs, the ISD, are then responsible for his inhumane treatment if ever it occurs. And therefore, if we as correctional services or anybody else, concerned parent, relative, or anybody else wants to complain, don't complain to DCS, go and complain to ISD and the police. Is that understanding an accurate understanding? That's all you need to understand, and we will take it and process it, and members will know to that way. That's how I understood it. But is there anything else on that? Let's ask members to, and then you could respond.
Yes, Chair. I just want to add, you know, if you look at the powers of the ICT, it's only a reactive, approach. And what we are talking about, once that person is out of your custody and when put in the custody of the police, there should be some sort of responsibility to ensure that there's a continuation of the conditions in which the person should be, you know, kept and kept at police stations.
In order to debate whether you agree or not, just that you clarify our understanding of what you said.
Thank you, Chairperson. Currently, this is the way it functions, and this is the way we're proposing that it should continue. The manner, I should maybe just add also that it's not just the ICD. If there's any complaints as to torture or ill treatment, these can be aired by the remand detainee in court, and that is usually what happens if he would say, well, I was forced to make such testimony, and then the court will launch an investigation. But it is reactive in that sense, and there is currently the ICD's mandate does not, but it falls within them, and the moment we hand somebody over to TAPS, it is out of our control.
As long as we have a common understanding, whether we agree or accept it, is something we'll debate on the 18th. Can we move on to the next issue? Thank you very much, Lara.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next issue was raised by the National Prosecuting Authority around the definition. We're still in Clause 1. We're now on page 3 of remand detainee. This is one of the examples where, this is actually the example where it's a legal argument raised by the National Prosecuting Authority. And had they done this, they've never raised this during the consultation process. They only came here to the committee. If they've raised this with us as a department, we would have taken this on board because we're in agreement with the recommendation, and that's why we're proposing that the definition of remand detainee be amended, as you can see my proposal there, taking on board the recommendation of the MPA and taking it further for our own purposes. So we're saying, because we're in agreement with the fact that when somebody's on appeal or review, he shouldn't be kept in the remand detention side, which is actually the current practice right now. So we're just realigning that wording in agreement with the MPA submission. And therefore, in future, it would read means a person detained, and this is now the A section of the definition, the B and C will stay, means a person detained in a remand detention facility awaiting the finalization of his or her trial, whether by acquittal or sentence, with the inclusion of the following at the end thereof, if such person is not commenced serving a sentence or is not already serving a prior sentence. That is just for us, and together, that wording is, of course, for the situation. And why do we keep acquittal in there? I know the MPA raised, why do we keep acquittal? But the person might be appearing on more than one charge, and one charge will be acquitted and another will be sentenced. So we have to use the term acquitted in here as well. And why we're referring to why if in some instance if somebody commits a prison offense and he goes through the normal procedure but he's already a sentenced offender, he now doesn't for this Daha or whatever gets placed over to the ATD section for the further charges. He will stay in the sentence section. That's why we need to add the words if such person has not commenced a sentence. Because if he's commenced a sentence for another charge, he will stay in that section. He won't be placed back. So, but we are reworking and we will come with a reformulated definition of remand detainee on the 8th then. And together with this should be reference to Clause 5, which will then be amended by the deletion of the reference of unsentenced offenders, because the previous definition of remand detainee stopped with conviction. We didn't include the sentence, so that's why we had a reference for unsentenced. Now remand detainee will include until the finalization of your trial, which is upon conviction and sentence. So we can remove any reference to unsentenced. So those should be read together, which was a comment made by other stakeholders as well. Then if there's no questions there, we move on to the NICRO in relation.
Just clarity on that one again for our own purposes. Examples were used of an individual that might have been found guilty but is waiting to be sentenced tomorrow or the next month or the next year, as opposed to the conventional remand detainee who has not been sentenced. Are we saying this then covers all those things? Because you'd remember the NPA was saying there's almost three categories. There's sentenced, unsentenced, and others that are guilty but not yet. So it covers everybody else.
Chair, it covers everybody else. That's why we have no more need for the term unsafe.
No, that's what I'm trying to understand, yes. But, and also just from our own, from a practical point of view, that individual that has been found guilty but not yet sentenced, that is in your custody, where are they housed? Because those that have been found guilty will then go into the cell, so to say. In other words, they will be in the sentenced section. Remand detainees, we are understood to be separated from, let me tell you what we understand. Our understanding is that if you're sentenced, you literally sleep and live somewhere. If you are ATD or remand detainees as we have it now, you're somewhere else. In other words, they don't mix. Now we have this third category that is not sentenced but found guilty. Where do they stay physically? That's the question that we're asking. Do they live with these that have not been sentenced yet, or do they live with these that have? That's just what we want clarity on.
First, and that's why we no longer refer to them as a waiting trial, and we're using the term remand detainee, because we can't place somebody, if you're found guilty tomorrow, we can't place you with a sentence, because the court might sentence you to a non-custodial sentence. So we only place you over once the court has handed down a direct incarceration sentence, because the court might even say 5 years but fully suspended. So we can't place you over to the sentence. We will keep you in the remand detainee section until you're sentenced. And that's how it currently operates as well. And they are separate. Remand detainees are separate. It's only once you're sentenced and the sentence has been handed down that you're placed over to the correctional facility.
It might assist to understand sentenced for purpose of this bill to mean a person who is serving a custodial penalty. Because on the surface, sentenced is a misleading word for purpose of this bill. Sentenced might mean, as Lirette is saying, you are sentenced, but it's a non-custodial penalty. So if it is understood that sentence refers to those who are serving a custodial penalty, I just thought that we should. So when you are convicted and awaiting a sentence, for our purposes, you are still a remand detainee. You have not yet commenced serving a custodial penalty.
That's fine. We'll debate. That's fine. I mean, as long as we're clear on it so that we don't have to call the department when we're behind closed doors. Because, I mean, these are things that must happen our discussions with you. If we're clear, as long as we understand it, we understand what is. Okay. So we don't have three categories for this bill. We just have two. Custodial sentence and those that either are waiting to be sentenced or have been sentenced but have not been rubber stamped, whether it's custodial or correctional or whatever. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Again, Chair, for the sake of precision again, in terms of the Extradition Act, there will be no custodial penalty, but there will be an order by the minister that Loiso is eligible for surrender to a requesting state, or Loiso must be released from remand detention, because the minister attaches Loiso not to be eligible for surrender to a requesting state. So for purpose of the definition of the remand detainee, in terms of the Extradition Act, there again, the threshold is, what is the ruling of the Minister of Justice? Should he be surrendered to the requesting state, or should he not be surrendered to the requesting state? And that determines the point at which remand detention for Loiso, so in terms of that act, comes to an end.
Yeah. I could add that's the B and C section of the definition. I think we're only amending the A section, so we're keeping that. So it includes that, yeah. Okay. Then Nico asked a question for clarification more than anything else. They asked whether the reference to police cell or lockup in the definition of remand detention facility meant that DCS will be assigning a DCS remand detention official to such facilities. The answer to this is no. As indicated, the reference to 115-117 is only in terms of the offences for escaping. So it's again that understanding that when we talk about remand detention facilities, we don't include police cells or lockup unless we're referring to escapes or aiding escapes, so no. Then if we move on to clause two, and yes.
And again, for our clarity, it's similar to the issues we were discussing about the inspecting judge. Once you've handed him over, you wash your hands of everything and anything that could happen or must happen to that individual until he's brought back to you. Mike.
With regard to this particular one, I think the question was whether by including police lockup cells in the definition, are we saying that therefore we'll be sending officers to that cell? This is not just referring to those who are transferred, but even those that the police arrest and put there. So the answer is no, we will not be doing that. So this is not just a transfer matter.
Thank you, Chairperson. Clause 2, you will see, deals with, it's one of those sections in the Act where we basically stipulate our core principles for DCS, and we're adding in here the management of remand detainees, since it's a policy decision. We want to make it clear now that we take it serious. It falls in together with the fact that we're establishing a branch for this specifically, and all of those factors that we're now really giving much more attention to remand detainees, where previously it was sort of a stepchild, maybe if I could use that. So we're trying to include it in the core principles. Sorry, the Commission for Gender Equality made a submission here that they do not view paragraph D, that's what we're adding, the wording manage remand detainees, to promote the rights of a remand detainee adequately, and recommends the following revision. And then they say manage remand detainees where such detainees will be placed in conditions and be allowed to exercise their rights, save for those limited lawfully. The DCS rejects this proposal, Chairperson, since the adding of such additional wording will in actual fact limit the management of remand detainees, which is merely intended here as a broad policy statement. It's the core principles. We don't want to limit it to what we see as the management of remand detainees. The rights of remand detainees are adequately spelled out in the Constitution in Chapter 5 of this bill, and it's further not clear what is meant by placed in conditions in their definition provided there, or which rights are referred to here in such broad terms. So DCS at this stage rejects that recommendation. We will just like to keep it just a pure policy statement of management of remand detainees. Then the CSPRI submitted that it's not clear what is meant by managed remand detainees, since the DCS has always had this responsibility. Well, the DCS has had this responsibility, but it was never given adequate emphasis within the department. Therefore, in 2006, Cabinet Lekgotla directed a cluster project aimed at refining the remand detention system in South Africa on the basis that remand detention is a distinct function from corrections. And in 2009, Cabinet again asked for the further establishment of a branch. In other words, the inclusion of the words management of remand detainees amongst the founding principles is aimed at giving acknowledgement to the fact that the management of remand detainees is a distinct function from corrections, and that's the way we see it. If we could clarify for CSPRI in that sense.
Comments before you move on?
This place devil's advocate, and I'll continue to do this and so that we understand it. This thing of managed remand detainees, when we go and do our oversight visits, you get remand detainees in a cell, they have TV, they're able to go to a doctor if they want to go to a doctor, get medication and all those type of things. When they move from you to the police facility, there's no TV in the police facilities. And not that I support the TVs, by the way. I would do away with them if I had it my way. But I'm just, and I think this is what people are saying, that when they're there, these are the things, whether we like it or not, these are the things that they are afforded. When they go to SAPS, will these things be afforded to them? We know it's not going to be afforded to them. And is there not discrimination between the two? I think that is what people are arguing. You are saying that, look, unfortunately, it's not going to be the same. Because I think that's what they talk about when they talk about manage. Because when you manage, you're managing from 6 in the morning until 6 the next morning, will people not come back tomorrow and say, look, you know what, I don't want to go there because at least here I can watch the news. If I go there, I don't watch the news. I don't know. And again, we're going to get to this point. That's why I have a problem with it personally. I don't know if it's conceivable or not, but let me say devil's advocate. What happens if somebody is in police custody for 3 weeks, because he was there for a week. They've asked for extension. For whatever reason, he's there for 3 weeks. If he was in our remand detention center for 3 weeks, he would have had access to TV, maybe. He would have had all those access. In the police, we know he won't have that access. Is there an argument for discrimination in this instance? And I think that is what people are talking about when they're saying remand detention. We get your point that it's out of your hands, because we've discussed that earlier on, that it's out of your hands. The question just is, when South Africa Incorporated come and ask us as lawmakers, but how are you allowing this process to happen? And that is why, for me, the 7 days is fine. We argue that, yes, well, anyway, 7 days, he can live without it. But when it gets to 3 weeks, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm saying when we make legislation, we must make legislation considering all the aspects, and also legislation for the next 30 years. So this management part that I think people are concerned about is, there's clearly going to be a different, in inverted commas, privilege regime, in inverted commas. I'm not saying TV and those things are privileged. What is our view on that matter?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's very important to see when will people be with SEPs. And there's different, three different scenarios in here. One is when they're being transported to court. Another is the provision where we will come to for further investigation, which is currently the case on a daily basis that they're being taken out. And then the third one is where we do not have facilities nearby and they're being detained. Now, in the instance where we do not have facilities nearby and they're being detained, it's because of practical realities at the moment, and if we take it away, we can look maybe it's 20 days that we're currently staying, not too long, and we can limit the number of days. But in reality, we might fail if we take it out completely, the number of days that they can stay in a specific, where they must stay in a holding cell to attend court in a specific area. And then we will have to, what the court will do in that instance is the same with now for the further investigation. Say it's the 7 days, you can live with the 7 days maybe. But now if you're extended, you have to do it on a good reason. And if a person then complains and goes to the court and challenges us that we didn't have a reason for detaining him with or for handing him over to SEPs for such a prolonged period where he does not have access to these other resources, the court will weigh the reasons that we've used to see if it was a reasonable and justifiable decision in terms of the constitutional provisions and the guidance the courts have given on the interpretation. So we will be measured, and that's why we as a department, it's something we do daily when we can't always, discrimination isn't necessarily treating people differently. It's when you differentiate without a good reason and when you differentiate on a prolonged period. And we, in making these management decisions and handing them over, and SEPs coming to us and say, well, the reason we need this person is for identity parade or to go to in loco. He's part of a transit, cash and transit gang. They've hit Durban, Joburg, Cape Town. He needs to go there and point out things, or he needs to go and appear in identity parades in different provinces. And we do not have control over the fact that it's going to take 3 weeks to transport him all over. But then if the court sees this justifiable reason, I'm sure nobody's limits is, you can always limit rights if you do it in a reasonable, justifiable manner. So it's not absolute. So I think in weighing up the interest of the criminal justice system, I think it's always a balance that we need to strike.
Again, on this point, Chair, I wanted to get a clarity in terms of the I'll use our own language of say inmate that are going to be taken to the cell of the SAPS in terms of the inmate that is sick. Are this bail going to accommodate them? Because another challenge that we face with when we go to oversight, you'll find that on the inmate that is staying at the cell that calls a waiting time. That inmate, when is sick, then you'll find that in terms of the to get maybe a sick parole or whatever, the parole board is only focusing only on the inmate that are sentenced, and the inmate that are not sentenced are not getting that sick parole, or to be taken care in terms of or of the sickness, because they will tell you that it's a waiting trial, then they don't have any powers for this person. Example, in Johannesburg prison, we found the inmate that was sleeping in the cell and sick. You can see that this person can leave at any time. But because our medical is only focused on the inmate that are sentenced, are not focusing on the people that are not unsentenced, is it this bill going to cover them, or still going to be separate or limited? I don't know. And if by what is going to happen to this person that is going to stay for 3 weeks, Eselia Mapois, in terms of health, what this bill is going to do on that?
Thanks, Chair. I think just to start with what Mangwenya is raising, Honorable Mangwenya is raising, I think the responses of our presentation were dealing with the issues that were raised in the submissions. But to respond to this issue, I think that the very reason why this bill is here and the need that Cabinet recognized to develop a white paper was as a result of the recognition that lack of or absence of adequate legal provisions regarding the management of remand detention discriminates against those in remand detention with regard to services. So I think there are provisions in the bill that provide for them to have similar rights, if not same set of rights as those that are sentenced, in terms of access to medical parole, of course, following certain procedures. But the question that Umangwenya raised, I think, comes back with regard to those who are transferred to the police, comes back to the very point that you, Chair, are raising. And my sense is that we will need to decide as Parliament and as government whether some of the problems that are there in the police generally can be resolved through this law. Whether this law is the appropriate way of dealing with those, and if that is the case, how do we deal with that? Because the question is not so much the issue of whether DCS is dumping people or throwing them or saying you are no longer taking responsibility for them. I think the question is whether the police, the manner in which the police cells are managed and administered, is in compliance with the law and the constitution. I think that is the issue. Which we might need to resolve. I don't want to respond in terms of that right now. But I think that it will keep on coming up each time when we talk about transfers, and we deal with it as if it is a matter of whether you can transfer or not transfer, or whether you can say the management of detainees includes those in lockup in police. I think this question will come up in variations. But the point of that question is whether we believe or convince, as we sit here, administrators or lawmakers, whether we're convinced or satisfied that the manner in which police cells are managed and administered is in accordance with the law and the constitution. I think that's a question that will always arise, because it's a question that we can answer here right now, and we might not be adequately equipped to deal with it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I we take your point. It's a cluster matter. And maybe it's the wrong place to put it to you, but at least you understand that our concern, we don't have a line where our concerns stop as members of parliament. Whereas departments might have, this is your jurisdiction as corrections, this is your jurisdiction as SAPS. Ours is from life to death, but we will raise it at the correct forum, whether it's in our cluster meetings or somewhere, as long as you understand the sentiment, and we are able then to also go back to whether it's the Commission for Gender Equality or NICRO or anybody else, and justify why we, because tomorrow we also have to respond to these people as to why you've been convinced that is correct or not correct. But and some of them are here. I'm sure they will sharpen us before the 8th. You're welcome to do that. Vanessa and CPRI and even the media. if you want to sharpen us before Wednesday and say, we heard what these guys are saying, but tackle them from this angle, you are free to do that to us. Because all of us are, I think, on the same page in terms of trying to make this thing as watertight as possible. Thank you very much, Loretta. If you can move on.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe just to, for the Honourable Member, before I move on, in Section 49E, which we will come to, we specifically now create for remand detainees in our centres a system to deal with terminally ill or very severely ill remand detainees, which we've never had before. And the thing is, because they're being placed for such short periods with the South African Police Service, the head of the centre will still be able to use this process to assist seriously ill inmates in my remand detainees, in my view. But we will come in detail to that provision, which is for the first time that we will have such a provision. Clause 3, where we were on page 5, clause 3 deals with just the insertion of, clause 3, of course, deals with section 5 of the Principal Act, and here we're inserting just references to remand detention facility in existing legislation. So it's basically the insertion of a terminology, but of course this is the provision which currently refers to the detention in police cells, and therefore...
before we get totally confused, when you refer to page 5, you're referring to your summary or to that? But that's fine. Okay, so that we all follow. So when you refer to page, you refer to here. When you refer to the bill, if you become some creative so that we are not confused on our side. Okay, fine. With you.
Sorry, confusing. The first comment here was from the Commission for Gender Equality, which submitted that a positive obligation should be placed on the executive to place remand detainees in conditions commensurate with the right to dignity and security, and according to the CGE, recommended that the paragraph should be amended to read, the minister must. Now, the paragraph they're referring to is paragraph A, which deals with the minister may, by notice in the Gazette, establish and review the establishment of correctional centres and remand detention facilities. It's our view that it's not clear how the creation of remand detention facilities, which is clearly at the discretion of the minister, could influence the conditions within which remand detainees are detained within such facilities. Section 4 of the Act already addresses the DCS's obligations in regard to the safe custody of inmates, both sentenced and unsentenced, which would now be called remand detainees. DCS therefore rejects this proposal. We cannot make it compulsory for the minister to establish centres and in that manner protect rights. So we're rejecting this comment for the now. The second comment by the CGE submitted that it supports paragraph B because it limits the period for which a remand detainee can be held in a police cell. Now, paragraph B is the section in the existing Act where we're only inserting terminology. We're not changing any period of time. The amendment merely inserts terminology, so the month period is the existing period that somebody can be detained in police custody. It's that provision where we don't have a correctional center close by. It's that existing provision. So I think the CGE was maybe not aware of the fact that currently it is a month. Then the CSDRI submitted in reference to subsection 2B that police cells are in general not suitable for detention beyond a few days and can frequently be added. It's the same argument that we've been having this morning. Here we again say that we're only adding in terminology and that the regulation of incarceration police cells has not been amended to reflect the existing position. The provision serves to regulate practical problems experienced due to the unavailability of correctional or remand detention centres in certain parts of the country. And then we give an example of the Free State Northern Cape area, which is serviced by Grootvlei Maximum, and remand detention facility, which services, this is a remand detention facility, which services Fort St. Petersburg, Brandfort, Fitchburg, Smithfield, which are long distances away. And in these instances, if the next court date is close to when the court, say the court just says we're going in recess for 2 days and we will resume the matter again after 2 days, then there's a probability that the remand detainee may be kept at the local holding cells of staff. And staff in these jurisdictions have to travel long distance. It's just the explanation by the branch of why currently we have this provision. So it's one of the three scenarios where we had people over to staff. Then the inspectorate again raised it's linked, maybe I should just...
You, so that you don't go close by close, I think that is part of it. But let's tell you what is our major concern. And I think it was raised by by the prosecuting authority. They use the example of Clarkstock and Potchefstroom. First, there's two things. If indeed somebody is somewhere where there is no facility in DCS, what is the limit of that person being there? That's the first question you must answer. But the second one that was more important for me was, you recall that Advocate Smith said, in police, or in that type of scenario, where there's no remand facility, you're then going to have a scenario where Vincent has been, I suppose, arrested. He's waiting there because he must go to court tomorrow, because you're saying it's far away. And then you have others that have been picked up today also in there. How is that thing going to be managed? You recall you would say that some are on their way to court, some are on their way back to a facility somewhere. They were there just because it was far away from the correctional services facility. In practical terms, how are we going to manage that? Or how do you respond to the prosecution's case about the Clarkstock Potchefstroom issue? Because it is undesirable to have people that are coming from ourselves mixing up with people that haven't even been to ourselves before, because they're all sitting in one police facility. How do we deal with that matter? And those that are in facilities because of the proximity to DCS facilities, are there time frames for them to be there?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask Mr. Damons to deal with the practicalities, because this happens daily now, and to explain how we see the remand. I think it's important for the committee to have understanding of how we view remand detention facilities and what we, if we refer to that terminology now, because I know the NDA raised the issue of a small little town, where you, for that understanding of what we mean with a remand detention facility and this issue of kilometers. But as to the period is what is existing. It's here on page 3. Now I'm referring to page 3 of the bill. And it's this paragraph, subparagraph B of the existing Act. The period has always been, we're just inserting new terminology, but it reads, if there's no correctional center or remand detention facility in a district, an inmate may be detained in a police cell, but not for a period longer than a month, unless a longer period is authorized by the National Commissioner. That is the current position. And I would like Mr. Damons now to, and whoever else would like to add to the practicalities of how it operates.
Currently, the time that the remand detainee is spent in police lockup facilities, that's within the police prescripts. And I think, therefore, the attempt of the bill now is to give a specific period. But the period also depends on the finalization of their investigation. So we only act as a department when we receive this remand detainee with EJ7 or requisition. Then we can't refuse to accept it. But the period which they stay in police cells, we don't have any control over it. That's the current situation.
I think a different system here. And we're just doing it for practicality, because we want to sharpen this thing. Let's assume we go to, I don't know, Postmansburg, where there's no DCS facility. However, there's a magistrate's court there. And we have Vincent that was maybe in Kimberley facility that must appear in Postmansburg magistrate's court. All right? So he's in our custody. We are transferring him to the police for the purposes of appearing in court. We do that today, and Vincent is going to sleep there tonight. But at the same time, the police in Postmansburg pick up a serial rapist today. And they're keeping him there because he must appear there tomorrow and probably be transferred to Kimberley. In other words, there's one that has already come from our facilities in the police custody in transit to court. There's one that comes from the street in the police facility on his way to the magistrate's court for him to be dealt with one way or the other. The question that I'm asking, and I know it's not your responsibility, but I just want to understand how it works in practice. Are these two individuals, is it possible that they could spend that night in the same cell? That's the question that I'm asking. If it is possible, just say yes or no, because it's something that we would then have to deal with somewhere else. We're raising this question because it then becomes a potential exchange point. That I'm here, I'll go and see the magistrate, but I'll be sent back to Kimberley tomorrow, and somebody else will be able then to come there and give him a knife, give him a gun, give him drugs, give him whatever, because he's going there, coming back, and hopefully tomorrow he goes back to his DCS facility. How does that work in practice? It might not be right, but in all these small areas, I'm sure it happens. Is there a way of us keeping them separate, although they're no longer in our custody? That's the question that I'm raising.
Chairperson, there's two scenarios. The one is where there's a clear indication for this practical one, where the police come, take him out for further investigation. Then we expect him back for a certain period. They can mix in the police cells, because it happened. That police holding cells, there's one cell or two cells, they keep them in the same cell. Then the other scenario is when we release the remand detainee for court purposes, we give them their belongings, their private stuff, everything, and we release them, in fact, physically from the prison. So what happened now around, we don't have control over that. So we book them up, not return from court as a release person.
The thing is interesting. Okay, I'll allow you, Mr. Max. But look, you know, sometimes I'm in remand detention for crime A, and the police might want to see me for another crime. Let's put it that way. Now, remember what we said yesterday, that Vincent must now wear a blue uniform. So Vincent goes from Sun City to Elders Police Station in a blue uniform because he's a remand detainee. However, in El Rarofa Police Station, Mpo comes straight from the street who has civvies on. Because remember, he's not reached correctional center. So you have somebody in a blue uniform and you have somebody with civvies in the police remand detention center. Now, part of the reason why we wanted uniform was so that Vincent doesn't escape, and we accept that. But there's nothing that says Mpo and Vincent can't exchange uniforms on that night. And then Mpo goes back because he's got the uniform, and Vincent, who's a criminal, I'm talking about the practical part of it. Have we thought about that? Because these are some of the things raised by the prosecuting authority, and how do we deal with it? That's the point that I'm making. But let's ask Mr. Max to raise another one. We're talking about this in transit period, Mr. Max, and then we'll allow you to respond and move on. Yes, sir.
Jay, what you are saying is so correct. You know, any law might be very romantic in its notion, but the question is whether it's practical in its implementation. And you don't have to go even to the place which you mentioned before. Just here in the metro, when they come from Portsmouth, they are not separated in the cells. They are mixed. And that I'm saying with confidence. If you take Maritzburg is 2.5 hours from Beaufort West and another 2.5 hours from Graaf Reinet in the middle, on the border. They are mixed. I visited those cells in my previous capacity. So we can move for a law here, but we have to ensure that what we actually ask for can be implemented outside. And for that particular reason, it is important that we address this issue at the other level, the joint committee as well, to make sure that it has been implemented properly. Thanks.
Again, it comes back to the point that I think Mike raised. It's outside of your hands, and we accept that. But we will always flag these things. Unless we're seeing it wrong, you can say to us, no, it's not necessary. But we'll flag them so that we raise it with the other stakeholders, because there's very little you can do about it. Quite. Unless there's something you can do, please sharpen our understanding. Yes, Commissioner.
Chairperson, on the issue of transit, let's suppose he's going to court. When an inmate, a remand detainee goes to court, he is in his civilian clothes. He's no longer in green or blue. He has to change.
No, that's fine, Commissioner. We argued differently yesterday. Let's tell you why. We don't want to get into a debate. Let me tell you why we argued differently. Because we said at the time, part of your motivation for somebody to wear a uniform was so that he does not escape. Very few people escape from your facility, we were told. They escape from the magistrate's courts, and they escape whilst in transit. So if that uniform is to deter escaping people or to make them easily recognizable, I'd rather have them wear the uniform when they are in magistrate's court so that we can identify them, or whether they're in the car. Because if we have it that they have that uniform on whilst they're in a sentence in an area where they hardly escape, then it's meaningless. If that was the motivation, and that was what we were led to believe to be the motivation. Now I'm saying that's what we were led to believe. You'll have to convince us otherwise if that's not the case. If that's not what it was meant for, and it was meant purely so that Vincent doesn't come with Gucci jeans and somebody else with something else into your center, you would need to say that to us, because then that argument can be understood. But I think broadly, the argument was about escape. Really and truly, our understanding at the time it was, had these five people escaped and they had uniform on, everybody would have been able to see that Vincent shouldn't be in the center of Commissioner Street if he has some sort of a uniform on. And it would have been easily detectable at the time. That's how we understood it. Maybe there's been a change. If there's been a change, we can live with it. But that is why I'm saying, Commissioner, that we even raised that argument yesterday. In fact, some of us said that we know in certain countries where people go with those uniforms to court. I mean, there's no law that says that Vincent can't go with a sort of uniform to court. I think it was the inspecting judge that said eventually people will get accustomed to the fact that if you don't have an orange one and you have a blue one on, it's not like you're a sentenced somebody. You are somebody that is there for whatever purposes. So I think our argument is that, you know, for a very long time, we've made laws in this country that are, as Mr. Max says, romantic and ideal, but can never be carried out. In practical terms, can never be carried out. And I don't want us as this committee to have theory that satisfies South Africans and not the practice that follows it. So that's why we'll continue to probe, continue to ask these questions. And where indeed these things can't happen in theory, we must be honest enough to say to the people, this is the ideal, but we know it's not going to be able to happen, as opposed to create a scenario where these are the panaceas for all our problems. If you want to respond, you can respond, but I think Mr. Max is correct that this is a police matter and we'll have to take it up with Cindy in police and take it further. But if you choose to give us your insight on this matter, please do so.
Chairperson, just two sentences, basically agreeing with your final comment that we can only legislate for our area of responsibility. The moment somebody is booked out with the police, they're no longer within our responsibility, and that's why they will have to change clothes. Unless the police agree in their act to say, well, we will do the clothing, but that's why our understanding is the moment you leave, and we're the comment of escape, we're legislating to against escapes from our centres. Last year, if you recall, this amendment comes directly from the 41 ATDs who escaped in one day from Harry Smith. 41, and that was amazing. They could just go into society, cross the border into the city from Harry Smith because they were not wearing uniforms. So we're legislating for our problem. We cannot legislate. SAPS must legislate if they want to legislate when people are in their vans or at court in holding cells, because unfortunately there we do not have the jurisdiction.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the point is that mostly we agree that the issue of uniform is a matter of a balancing act. There are issues about if you put someone who's on awaiting trial in a facility who is not yet convicted and therefore their innocence is presumed, do you give them uniform and therefore demean them, which is one concern on the one hand, and the other concern that says, do you let people to, for security reasons, not be identifiable either within a center or when they go to court? And I think I think the issue of uniform is still going to come, but I think the principle is one that where you say you need to balance. And in balancing those concerns, you might need to say, let's give them uniform at a particular stage, but reduce the extent to which you might be undermining their dignity to an extent, as long as you look at those priorities. The point about uniform is that there are many reasons, Chair. There are issues of escapes. It's just one issue. I mean, the other issue is that we already have ATDs who are wearing uniform, either because they've got one set of clothes, and when they wash it, they don't get, they don't have any other one, and we give them this uniform. So, and then there are issues about the people who get targeted because of the kinds of clothes they wear, they become victims and all that. But I think the general acceptance from the submissions as well as comments of members is that we accept that they do need some form of uniform, but the issue is how do we balance the need for ensuring that security and the fact that they're identifiable with the concerns that at some point, whether when they go out to court or when they're in police vans, we need to ensure their dignity because they're not convicted. And that's the problem with balancing issues. You always have a situation where one concern seems to be stretching over the other or emphasized over the other. And unfortunately, that becomes the case with all these kinds of discussions. There's no right or wrong answer.
Chairperson, yes, I see Louisa wanted to.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, you raised an important point around the Northern Cape, Northwest scenario, small dorm, no remand detention facility. And it's very difficult conceptually to make a distinction between a SAFS mandate and a very clear borderline with a DCS mandate when the person is invariably going to come back to the DCS. And my view is that, which is what we have agreed to and should be enforced in fact already, is that some areas will require protocols between various departments. And perhaps it's another matter how you want to, which entity must ratify such protocols. Should the executive, should the legislature, for instance, be cited of such a regulation? It might just be prudent to suggest in those regulations, for instance, in the protocols, that the police, because they need to have these remand detainees for whatever purposes, must always keep them apart from those persons who are arrested. I don't know if I'm putting this thing across well enough. It's a regulation type of an issue. You may want to enact it in law, but my view is you have a choice, either in regulation or in law, you stipulate that when you have a remand detainee, keep them apart from those who are arrested. And then it's another function of providing the requisite resources to the police to make sure that they are able to do that. And that would have to be done, those regulations, in this particular instance, with other departments who, for one reason or the other, will have to keep custody of remand detainees, and those will be mental health care institutions, your normal health care facilities, your hospitals, and the courts themselves, because when Loiso is released in the morning for purpose of appearing in court from around 9 in the morning, once the police take me from Polsmo and I arrive at court, my understanding is that the mandate of the police, in a sense, ends at that point. Loiso becomes the responsibility of the Justice Department. The police are there to the extent that they are interested in having you prosecuted, and they will need the evidence when necessary, and they will have the orderlies to look after you, but you are in essence the responsibility of the Department of Justice. So you need, again, protocols with the Department of Justice to the extent that the people remain remand detainees when they are in court, before they are pulled from their holding cells by the orderlies to appear for whatever proceedings that will be processed against them. So I'm just suggesting, Chair, to be brief, that there needs to be these kinds of protocols that must be based on practice and that are, in fact, implementable. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you
very much.
Chairperson, on page 6 of the summary document, I'm not going to repeat this again. It's where I refer to the specific provision in the bill currently before Parliament of the ICD, which I've spoken to previously. It's the argument the discussion we've had this morning already. So I'm going to move on to page 8 and clause 4 of the bill. Clause 4 of the bill It just repeals the deletion or delete subsection 2 of section 10. Section 10 of the Principal Act deals with clothing for inmates. Here the CGE, I think, misread. They didn't read the act in, holistically, because their comment is they're worried that we're deleting subsection 2, which allows for RDs to acquire appropriate clothing and bedding, and therefore they submitted that they saw the deletion as untenable. But, of course, DCS is rejecting this proposal because although the provision is deleted in Section 10 of the Act, a new provision making the provision of clothing compulsory is inserted in Section 48. So I think we addressed the concerns actually more of in more detail than raised by the CGE in another provision. So if that was just for clarification. Then Clause 5 of the Bill. Clause 5 is the provision dealing in the existing Principal Act with opportunities and facilities that must be provided to remand detainees for the preparing of their defense. It's the existing provision. We're just changing terminology. The CSPRI submitted that the phrase opportunities and facilities to prepare their defense should be described in regulation within 1 year of the amendments coming into force. The regulation should prescribe that all inmates have access to the Act's regulations, the CPA, and relevant international instruments such as the UN Standard Minimum Rules for Treatment of Prisoners. This section, as I've pointed out, is merely amended here by the addition of new terminology. However, the Department appreciates the need for access to material identified by the CSPRI and will take steps to ensure increased access to correctional and remand detention centers of such material. This is, of course, not saying increased access to lawyers. Everybody has a right to a lawyer, but we, again, do not provide lawyers. The inmate is referred to the legal aid, Legal Aid South Africa, yes, they've changed their name from Legal Aid Board. So they deal with those concerns. The Institute for Security Studies submitted that since the definition of remand detainee includes unsentenced offenders, this we've already said when I opened in the definition, we're dealing with this, we're deleting the reference to unsentenced offenders, and remand detainee will now cater for that. The MPA submitted that the wording in the section is broadly and widely worded and will be open up to legal challenges. We reject this comment since this is the wording that's been used since 2004 and even before there in a similar fashion, and it's never been subject to a legal challenge because it's clear in practice what it means. You provide somebody with a room where an official must be present within sight but out of hearing, and all of those regulations are in place. We've never been challenged. If we have challenges, it's on an individual basis, not the overall section. Clause six deals with Section 38. Section 38. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Chair. I'm now with Clause 6, which amends Section 38 of the Principal Act. Section 38 lists everything that must be included in a sentence plan. Here we're just trying to add in the words restorative justice requirements. We've already in the department had a policy on restorative justice since 2000. But it's again reaffirming that we want to make clear that any sentence plan must make provision for this. Currently, sentence plans do make provision, but we want to make it a requirement in terms of the Act so that no center can circumvent this provision. The MPA here made a submission trying to refer to one definition in the JCPS cluster of restorative justice. Again, this was never raised during consultations, and it's my understanding that we understand from our side that we cannot force victims to engage, but this might take many forms. We see it as a very wide, and we've got a policy in place for restorative justice, which the department can present to the committee. So we do not really understand the comment that was made by the MPA there, because we cannot limit the definition in the cluster to one definition, and there isn't currently just one definition. Clause 7. Clause 7 amends Section 39 of the Principal Act. This deals with how sentences are interpreted. Here, we've only had one. It deals with how a sentence should run concurrently, or how, or whether you should first finish one sentence and then the next would commence, however which way we have to interpret it in the Principal Act. CSPRI submitted the proposed deletion of the reference to extradition act not clear. Here you can see our response is that there was an oversight and we're trying to add in absconders from the system. This deals with when the sentence stops running and when it starts again, and it was an oversight previously by not adding in absconders. The Extradition Act has never been used in practice, and there was therefore a recommendation the Department of Police remove it. But we've decided there's no damage or no harm can be caused by keeping it in the Act, so we will amend subsection 3. This is on page 4 of the bill. We will keep the reference to Extradition Act. It was, if that explanation is clear, we wanted to add in absconding, and we wanted to remove Extradition Act references, but we will keep it for now. Basically, subsection 3 will just read the date of expiry of any sentence of incarceration being served by a sentence offender who escapes from lawful custody, extradited in terms of the Extradition Act, or who absconds from the system of community correction or is unlawfully discharged, is postponed by the period by which such sentence was interrupted. So if we find the person again, his sentence will start running again. That's the essence of this section. If there's no questions, I will move on to clause 8. Clause 8, I'm just going to deal with the comments here. I will deal with the provision itself when we go clause by clause. NICRO submitted that subparagraph 6 should be amended to include a reference to a victim. If I could refer the committee, subparagraph 6 at the moment refers to the community. Already makes reference to the risk posed to the community, and the victim forms part of the general community and its general consideration in this regard. It's very seldom that the particulars of victims are recorded, and it would be difficult for a parole board in the absence of such knowledge to make a judgment call as to the risk posed to a victim. As where we have the information of the victim, it will be included. It's covered by this provision without making specific reference to the victim. That's the essence of what we're trying to convey here. Subparagraph 4, because subparagraph 4 currently reads, subparagraph 4, yes, it shouldn't be 6, the likelihood of a relapse into crime, the risk posed to the community, and the manner in which the risk can be reduced. This is the report that each inmate has a profile, which is compiled by the Case Management Committee, the CMC, and all this provision does is list documents that must be included. And why we're actually amending this provision has nothing to do with the comment of NICRO. It's on the next page where we're taking out the reference to habitual criminal. I drew the typo. It's subparagraph 4. Then clause 9. Clause 9 is inserting the whole new chapter 5. And here we deal individually with each new section. Section 46 would be the first there. The CGE submitted that section 46.1. Now, I must say firstly that section 46 deals with the management, safe custody, and well-being of remand detainees. 46.1 is as it is currently in the Act. We've only added in subsection 3. So subsection 1 and 2 is the existing provisions in the Act, and now the CGE made a submission in relation to subsection 1. They said it's in conflict with the Constitution because the rights of remand detainees cannot be restricted save for the right of freedom. CGE argues that proposing that remand detainees will be afforded immunity suggests that they are being treated as inmates. CGE further argues that the construction of this provision suggests that the rights of the remand detainees can be restricted and submits therefore that such a step allows for the rights of remand detainees to be unlawfully restricted as a result of poor understanding of what rights can be limited by correctional officials. CGE therefore recommended that the word amenities not be applied to remand detainees and the word rights be inserted to read as follows, and the wording is recommended there. You can see it on page 10. DCS rejects this proposal for the following reasons. Firstly, the wording of Section 46(1) has not been amended. In other words, the position has been as set out since 1 October 2004 with no legal challenges or constitutional challenges thereto. B, it is the DCS position that the only restrictions referred to in this provision are those necessary for the maintenance of security and good order, which wording the CGE is not proposing to amend. Therefore, the CGE's comment with regard to the unconstitutionality of this provision, in as far as it restricts the freedom of remand detainees, is not warranted. It is further not clear how the wording of this provision could lead to the unlawful restriction of the rights of remand detainees, since the application of the provision is clearly limited as outlined above. As to the CGE submission re-immunities, it is submitted that this provision plainly makes reference to immunities to which the remand detainee would have had access outside the facility. I don't know if I should read subsection 1 for clarity for members, but so, okay. Then the Center for CSPRI again raises similar submission as to the definition. Oh, we've dealt with this. This is where we're deleting subsection 3 as we set out initially, in line with the amendments we're making to the definition of remand detainee. The same applies to the second comment raised by CSPRI. We're addressing it since we're deleting subsection 3. The inspectorate, the same, and then ISS, the same. So we've already dealt with that under the discussion of the definitions clause. If I may move on then to section 48, which is the clothing provision. I see, unfortunately, sometimes when you print this kind of document, it didn't print the clause. Clause 9, section. Chairperson, I'm saying when we discuss clause 1, we agreed that we will delete it because it runs with that all the sections we were referring to in the definition of inmate. So since we're taking out all those references, we will also take out this reference because everywhere in the bill where you read inmate, you can read in remand detainee now. Thank you, Chairperson. Now, section 48 is the... Oh, okay, sorry. No, in my printing, I've printed the wrong page first, or I bound the wrong page. Section 47 we're now at. Section 47 deals with food and drink for remand detainees. And, sorry, now my pages are... The CGE indicated that remand detainees should receive proper amounts of food in accordance with their dietary needs. Therefore submitted that it's expected that food and beverages in the case of remand detainees should be allowed unconditionally subject to security clearances unless food is perishable or may pose a health risk. Therefore, the CGE submitted that this section cannot be supported in its current format and proposed the following. It said it proposed including the words reasonable before the restrictions and then also that regulations... let me just read it. Subject to reasonable restrictions which may be prescribed by regulations, remand detainees must be allowed food and drink from their visitors in the detention facility. If I can come to the DCS response. I'm sorry, my pages. DCS rejects this proposal for the following reasons. New Section 47 is merely a repetition of the existing Section 48 of the Principal Act. Apart from terminology, no content amendments are proposed to this section. The position with regard to policy and practice with regard to the provision of food to remand detainees by visitors has therefore been in place for a considerable period. It is unnecessary to insert the word reasonable since regulations which are unreasonable will in any case be open to a legal challenge. And then the retention of food and drink cannot be made compulsory. if such is provided by visitors, since the retention there was regulated by regulation as is indicated in the existing provision, and therefore offender may retain such commodities should it be authorized by regulation, should it not have posed a security risk or a health risk. It's, you can't make it limited on the one hand and make it compulsory on the other hand. That's the essence of the food provided by visitors, merely in addition to what, of course, DCS must provide as food for all inmates. In terms of Section 8, which amounts to the food and nutrition for pregnant mothers, diabetics, it's addressed in Section 8 of the Principal Act. We do cover that. And since the word inmate covers remand detainee, all the dietary needs of remand detainees with special needs will be addressed, and we have an obligation already in terms of the Act. Chairperson, if I may then move on to Section 48. 48, the clothing provision, here I see it for I, so supports the provision as long as it's implemented in such a manner that remand detainees provided with adequate clothing. Furthermore, submits that remand detainees should not be compelled to appear in court in the specified uniform. Response from our side at this moment is that remand detainees will not appear in uniform in court. It will be necessary to insert an additional subsection. It may be necessary here, stipulating. So I'm proposing a new subsection to be inserted saying no remand detainee is to appear in any court proceedings dressed in a uniform referred to in subsection 1. Currently, remand detainees who do not have private clothes, for instance, also forensics, if you have blood on your clothes, the police might want to take it for forensics, then we need to currently provide people with clothing. And such people, we actually have a budget for it, which Mr. Damon's informed us, that the... they're provided with what we call court clothes at present. We actually have suits in various sizes that we provide to remand detainees when they go to court. So we are in that practice already for those who have absolutely no private clothing. Then the inspectorate submitted that consideration be given to specifying that remand detainees can appear in their own clothing in court. Again, this is what was in their written submission, but then when the judge spoke to the position, he had a different. So I summarized this from the written submission. Again, we're proposing that if the committee is in agreement, we will draft another subsection to make it clear. The MPA submitted, that the practical implications of this provision do not seem to have been considered. This is one of the areas where we disagree with the MPA since it's gone through the cluster, and it's clearly it's a policy decision on the part of DCS, and it's not clear how this is not a legal argument. It's attacking a policy position, which we've had consensus on in the cluster. In order to reach this stage. Then Section 49, if there's
move to Section 49. Anything on clothing other than what we've already discussed, Mam Gwenya?
Thank you, Chair. I think this thing of clothing, Chair, still need a debate because the department needs to convince us why they want the inmate, the waiting time, wear the uniform. Because at the beginning it was said they want a uniform because most of the inmates are escaping when they go to court. But now, today you are saying the uniform, they are going to wear it only when they are in our facility. This thing needs to be clear, Chair, why we want this uniform. Because really, ababantu abakagwetjwa banelungelo lokugqoka impahla zabo. But if ever a person got a challenge of saying my clothes is full of blood or my clothes is dirty, is the duty of is the responsibility of the center to assist that person. But if we are saying we are making a law of wearing the uniform, we need to convince the people why we want this uniform. I'm saying this because we are going to use our budget in terms of making this uniform. It must be clear why we want this uniform before we use our budget to buy the uniform of the awaiting tribe. Thank you, Chair.
It's not debated. You can anticipate that there will be this argument, but added to or to emphasize what Mam Gwenya is saying is that you'd recall that although the advocate telephonically withdrew and will withdraw when he arrives, if he arrives. I thought there was a point that he raised that maybe we must look at. The cost implication. And I think Mr. Abram also spoke about, or somebody, I think Mpo maybe, or Mr. Abram spoke about the movement. These are not a stable community. They come in today, they're gone out tomorrow, they could be there for one day. In other words, are we going to have a storeroom full of uniforms that caters for large, extra large, small, that could all be used, or we could have a situation where we have the storeroom and they're not used? I'm just saying from a business point of view, taking into consideration that money is tight. We have argued that you must change your budget in terms of other priorities. Have we thought out the cost implications about this matter? I think those are the issues that Ngwenya is basically talking about. Let's forget about whether they must be used when they go to court or not, but just in the facility, 46,000 people, we have to have 46,000 new uniforms. Others are saying you can't just buy him one overall. You need to buy him two overalls or three overalls or an overall, a jersey. And I'm using 46,000 as the current. Maybe the average. Even if you're conservative, and we said at any given time there are 30,000 remand detainees, what is the cost implication of 30,000 remand detainees, if any? And how do we propose to budget for that without, as Mam Gwenya is saying, impacting on the other programs that we think are important, like rehabilitation, health, and those type of things? It's what you're going to have to convince us about, but if you want to make initial comments now, you can do so.
Thanks, Chair. Just as you say, I think it's safe to say an initial comment. I think, Chair, maybe it will be important that we resolve the issue of principle. And then look at what the operational implications would be and whether those can be planned for and all that, because this entire system of remand, despite the initial costs that have been done, which are basically indicative, will still have to be operationalized in terms of its implications to operations. But the principle is that we feel that we do need to have a way in which remand detainees have got a distinguishable set of clothing for security, for practical, and for management purposes. If we talk about the issue, for example, of escapes, I don't think the mere indication that escapes, there are more escapes happening in court and during transit, that indication doesn't suggest that there are no escapes at the center. Lirette was referring to a period last year where we had 41 inmates just walk out of a facility and nobody could identify them. So I think from a security point of view, we do need to have a distinguishable set of clothing for inmates. There are a lot of things that happen in centers. There are people who walk around the lawns and gardens and of the center and all that. There are people who come to visit. If you were to enter into the visiting area of an ADT facility, like let's say in Westville, and you enter there and you find during visitation hours that hall is packed, there's a lot of interaction there. At some point now, you may not know who is who. And I think it is important that for that purposes, people are distinguishable. There are people who might walk out of there with their relatives or exchange babies and all that. So there's a lot of reason for that. And I don't want us to start by saying what will be the cost without looking at what the justification and rationale is and deal with the issue of principle. If there are better ways in which the operationalization can be managed and we can be cost efficient and all that, I think that will happen. I mean, the talk of storerooms is a practical management issue. We already have different sizes of uniforms being stored in the centers already for 110,000 certain people. So it's a practical matter that we need to deal with. But I'm saying instead of first dealing with the practical management issues for implementation of this proposal. I think let's address first whether we're satisfied with the rationale and what it seeks to achieve. Because if we do not do that, we then would say, for example, we can say we want to introduce uniform, but it's something that currently with the competing needs of our resources, we want to bring in at a later stage within the particular year, whatever the case might be. Those are practical issues. I'm not saying that that's what in fact we're going to do. But as long as the rationale is there and we're able to legislate from a policy point of view here, I think the practical matters can be looked at. And if you would want us to come and present those for purposes of looking at whether they represent prudent use of state resources, we are willing to come and do that.
Thanks, Mike. No, I think we agreed. We agreed with the principle. But I also do think that if we agree with the principle and we legislate it, as you have it here, that we must also answer the other question that people are asking. We can't say you must have a uniform and we don't have the resources for that uniform. I mean, that is what we were talking about. So I don't think we are arguing about the principle. I think we agree on the principle. I think you're helping us, Mike, by saying that you might have to come and give us an initial idea of the affordability. Because once we approve this piece of legislation, and a month later you come back and you say, you know what, we actually don't have resources, but we must take resources from another program. It's going to be difficult for us to accept it. Because remember, we would have passed it, and then you come back and say to us, oh, well, we're going to have to minimize this. That is, I think, the concern that we have. And it's a legitimate concern that South Africans outside would have. You can't give somebody something to go to school because you say you don't have money for that in the department, yet you're spending X amount of rent. And I hear what you're saying, Mike. There are these things. We just want to be able to, one, be able to justify it to all our own stakeholders, but two, to satisfy ourselves. So we want to reiterate that we agree with the principle, and we've agreed with the principle from day one. The question just is, now that these things have been brought to our attention, which is the intention of public hearings, we must be satisfied that that principle will not make the department bankrupt. That's basically what we are arguing about. So I think there's agreement, but there will need to be a bit more fat added to it when we go to clause by clause, because I do anticipate that it's going to have some interesting questions. And it's not about us against you. We are all together in terms of when we implement this uniform, all of us must be able to make sure that it doesn't become detrimental to anything else that we are trying to do. I don't think anybody disagrees, not even CSIPR or NICRO or anybody. I don't think many people would disagree with you, including the inspecting judge, by the way. But it's how do we sell it to the populace and everybody else. Carry on, Lorette.
Chairperson, maybe I must just add, at the end of this document, the comment document we're looking at, we've provided for you estimated costs at the moment. It doesn't come with the implementation plan as to where it will fit into the budget. That discussion can take place through the commissioner. But we did provide you with estimated costs. And, I mean, the idea is that we do already have storerooms that will function on the similar. When you leave, we wash it, provide it to somebody else. And these, it's made from very strong cloth. It lasts actually on average 5 years, a uniform. So it's a once-off, and then after 5 years, you repeat some of them, but unless people do things to their own uniforms which damage them. But to continue to section 49, the safekeeping of information and records, this is where a lot of stakeholders had opposition to the inclusion of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. DCS in agreement, we've gone and reconsidered. We're going to remove all reference to the PAHIA here, because the fact is, if you read PAHIA itself, Section 5 of the Act, it actually says PAHIA trumps any other legislation which tries to regulate access to information. In other words, if you come to DCS at the moment and you make an application for access to information, we will, in any case, if it falls under PAHIA, process it in terms of PAHIA. We don't need to stipulate it here. And in the manner it was stipulated here, we would have impeded on access to information on things that we already give daily information, such as if your child is with us, where the child's being held. So we're taking out that reference, and I'm sure the stakeholders will be happy with that. So, because in any case, the PAI Act will regulate whichever request comes. So that deals with the submission from CSPRI, as well as the... It only appears in 49.1, and that's where we wanted to insert it as a new provision, and we're taking it out. Because previously it was never necessary to include it previously, because in any case, PAIA applies to all government departments and all stakeholders, so we apply PAIA in the department when it's necessary, but this provision would have been too restrictive. It would not have achieved what we wanted to achieve upon rereading it and in light of the comments received.
For clarity, 49.1 comes out in total. Thank you. All right?
In 49A, which deals with pregnant women, here we had a comment from the CSPRI. These are all new provisions. This is now the following four provisions, sections will deal with vulnerable groups. The first group being pregnant women, CSPRI. Now, again, I'm sorry, my page just seemed to be... Here I am. Oh, okay. See, previously, in terms of 46, concerns were raised for the wording with such changes as required by the context. In 49A, we say the provisions of Section 20 of the Principal Act apply to a pregnant remand detainee with such changes as may be required by the context. Now, if we look at Section 20, it deals with mothers and babies. And there are specific subsections in there which may not apply to a remand detainee. For instance, in terms of Section 20, you can have a child with you until the age of 2 years. Now, if you come in as a remand detainee, you might, unless your case takes very long, it might not apply to you or it might apply to you. So it won't always, that's why we need the leniency here of such circumstances to reply with such changes as may be required by the context. Should we limit any rights? The remand detainee in any case is right to go to court and say, well, my rights are being limited unfairly because sentenced women have access to X, Y, and Z. But it's merely included here as to give us leniency. Also, that provision, Section 20, deals with the fact that we must assist people to apply to the Department of Social Development for alternative arrangements with children. She might be pregnant whilst awaiting trial and only have the child once sentenced. Then that provision kicks in, but it won't necessarily... we won't start that process until she's sentenced, for instance, if she's not. So it gives us a leeway in practice. It's not taking rights away. That's the way we wanted to explain why we have the words here. In other legislation, you often have this, and it's the terminology mutatis mutandis, which you will see in a lot of other legislation, but in terms of new drafting guidelines by the State Attorney's Office, we now, instead of using the Latin, we say with such changes may be required by the context, but it's a general provision used in a lot of legislation, and it's not intended to limit rights. Should rights be limited, the inmate has recourse to courts in any case. Then on...
Continue, Mam Gwenya.
Yeah, Chair. this Section 20 is also bring us back in terms of the awaiting trial, women and baby, in terms of allocation on their health. We're saying our inmates that are in our center, which is awaiting trial. I want to get a clarity check. That are we saying the inmates that are in awaiting trial, that have baby or maybe atole umtwana, meanwhile waiting trial. This bill is going to accommodate that woman. Is it the responsibility of the correctional or is it the responsibility of the police? I want to get a clarity there. You'll remember, Chair, last year, I think on November, we're having the public servant that was presenting here that to say there was a person that was injured in the van of the police, and that person was submitted to our center. And that person said the center didn't want to help him because the accident was happened outside the center. But ungena manje a center yethu ye correctional efelimele lo muntu and irresponsibility ngoku ngekabani same apply nakuleyo ka mama nomntwana. Even if that woman can be awaiting trial aboshwe namhlanje and take to our cell, there's an awaiting trial, whose responsibility is it? Or is it for police, court, or a correctional? I think even that one, Chair, need a debate in terms of our cluster. Irresponsibility, Gaba. Thank you.
And I hadn't looked at it, I must be quite honest. Again, I think it's more from a practical point of view so that we know where to locate it in our engagement with our colleagues. If there's somebody in a waiting trial and delivers a baby whilst they are still in a waiting trial, whose responsibility is it? Because we know, first of all, that there must be a creche and all those good type of things. How do we deal with that, I think, is the question. The cost implications, is it really our baby as DCS, or is it still a responsibility of the police and that type of thing? I don't know how frequently it happens, but I think that's the point that's been raised. And Mamgwenya raises the point that, you know, there was a scenario where whilst we had done this transfer to the police, somebody gets injured, whilst in police custody, 2 minutes later they come to us and we say, as we said earlier on, you know what, that thing happened whilst it was not in our jurisdiction. And therefore, if you lie there and bleed and die, your parents can fight with the cops and not with us, type of argument that was raised. And I'm saying again, Mike, maybe these are operational things that we're going to have to sit and look at, all of us, because we can't leave that thing. But how do we handle remand detainees who have children younger than 2 years old? Just generally, if you came to my house and you picked up Cindy, and Cindy's a newborn mother, do you take her and her baby because she's guilty of something, or do you give her time to give it to whoever? Because on the other hand, those that are sentenced are given 2 years, up to 2 years to do the bonding and whatever. Just from a practical point of view, how do we handle that? And secondly, if Cindy gives birth while she's in remand detention, how do we handle it?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to briefly speak to it, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Gordon from Baltimore or Mr. Diamond to speak to the what happens in the centre practically, because I'm not the DCS official in that sense. But my understanding is, firstly, let's talk about the injury that the inmate had in the van. In law, we are not liable. You cannot sue the Minister of Correctional Services for those injuries. You would sue the Minister of SEP. But the moment that person arrives with the injuries, we have a duty to take care of him. Because upon admission, we must do a health check, everything. We cannot refuse medical treatment. I mean, even in terms of constitution, every person, not even every citizen, has a right to medical treatment. So that would be irregular, and we would be liable if we have not done that. We must take care of the medical aspects, but if the person wants to sue somebody for compensation, it would not be us in terms of law. Then, as to pregnant women, that's why this provision, it's always been the case that if you come in with a child, there was nobody there who could take care of the child until the age of 2, even as a remand detainee, you have the child with you. You actually take the child to court with you if you go and appear. So the child's not taken away until the age of 2. Then it's where social development comes in and arranges with placement. So it applies to both sentenced and awaiting trial. And they must have similar facilities with creches, nurses. That's what we're trying to cater for. I would like people just to speak maybe to the practice of that as well.
Yes, Mr. T. The current situation is that if a lady comes in and she's pregnant and she delivers a baby, we're taking responsibility at the correction center, at DCS. We're taking current responsibility to that effect. we will treat them, we will take her to hospital and all these things. What is happening around them, we do it as correctional services. She's still a waiting child at our center if it happens like that. And on that one, and the first one also, before admittance, it is totally responsibility of the police because we didn't admit the person yet with injuries. But if we admit her and she comes, the person comes at the gate for his, at the reception, yes, we need to apply and we need to give a see to the injury. And then we cannot accept an offender, an inmate, when there's a warrant for the those offenders.
Chairperson, we then move on to disabled remand detainees. It's a new.
Chair, I would like to understand this wording, which says, as may be required by the context. Can you break this down in layperson's language? What does it mean? As may be required by the context. Context of what?
Okay, and I mean, you walked in just after they had done that. They have, and also, Mr. Ibrahim, we have said that this is, as you say, just for clarity, but we're still going to have an opportunity to argue it and agree or disagree with it. We just want their initial. We will sit and maybe if you raise that question. In our closed session, we'll try and explain it as best as possible, and if you convince us otherwise, we'll have a second bite at the cherry. Is that okay, sir? Thank you very much. We received the apology, and we hope that nobody was seriously injured in the bursting of your geyser at home. Blame public works.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then Section 49B, as I said, it's a new section on disabled remand detainees. Here the Gender Equality Commission for Gender Equality submitted that the obligations placed on the National Commissioner should be compulsory or else the DCS will fail to give priority to the needs of disabled remand detainees. Therefore, the CGE recommended the following wording. The National Commissioner must take necessary steps towards placing remand detainees with disabilities in separate detention facilities, which are specifically designed to accommodate persons with disabilities. I'm going to deal with the second comment of CGE as well before I respond. CGE also submitted that subsection 2, sorry, I left out the W there, it seems, must be amended to provide, as follows, the department must provide within its available resources additional health care services based on the principle of primary health care. The DCS cannot give effect to these proposals for the following reasons. The provision must be read together with Section 12 of the Principal Act, where the provision of basic primary health care is provided for as a duty on the part of DCS. In other words, we're compelled to do certain basic health care already. This subsection deals with provision of health care services in addition to basic services. One of the basic principles in drafting legislative provisions is that the line function department should be able to implement it once it has been put into operation. DCS will not be in a position to implement this provision in a manner proposed by CGE at all 240 centers nationwide should it be put into operation with immediate effect. Even if the entry into force of this provision is delayed until such time as the DCS is in a position to do so, it's unlikely that it will become operational for years to come. However, by putting the provision into operation in the manner proposed in the bill, the DCS will immediately be in a position to provide specialized services to disabled as and when required within the discretion of the National Commissioner. The provision of health care is one of those rights that even the Constitution acknowledges should be attained through progressive realization within the available governmental resources. The wording of subsection 2 should therefore remain may and not must. Similar, I must say from the outset, maybe before there's a discussion on this point, maybe I should go through all the comments because other commentators had similar comments. the CSPRI submitted with reference to within its available resources that this renders the provision meaningless and without enforceability. It was further submitted that the reference to additional health care services is unclear and that many services required may go beyond health care services. Therefore, the CSPRI recommended the following, that the department must provide healthcare services. Now, remember, this must is in each instance, it refers to additional things which people with disabilities may need. So that's why we have a duty as a must in Section 12 of the Act to provide basic primary healthcare. But now we're trying to create for ourselves within our available resources to say, if we have somebody with a disability, and then we should try to give additional healthcare if it's whatever the situation may be. Then secondly, they propose that the department must provide additional psychological services if recommended by a medical practitioner. A similar submission is made by the CSPRI in relation to a section we will deal with a bit later. Again, the department cannot give effect to these proposals for the following reasons. The reasons set out above that I've dealt with around available resources and the fact that we have a duty for basic primary health care, and these are additional services. The provision of compulsory supportive services with no definition of such services will put the department in an untenable position. This is where they're saying people with disabilities need more than just health services. Now, they're talking about additional services. By the introduction of this provision, the DCS acknowledges that remand detainees with disabilities require special attention and additional services, and therefore subsection 1 makes specific reference to the detention of such inmates in accommodation specifically designed for persons with disabilities. As indicated above, the national implementation of these provisions will, however, be limited by the DCS's resources, but the DCS must strive continuously to roll these out in a progressive manner across the country. Similarly, the inspectorate submitted that although it welcomed the attention given to vulnerable groups, it would rather advise, advise enacting specific regulations for such cases rather than proceeding with the current format in legislation. The department could then be required to provide a specific time-restricted plan against which the reasonableness thereof can be measured. The DCS cannot support this recommendation for the following reasons. There are currently no legislative provisions dealing with these vulnerable groups, and this is a first step in that direction. There is no guarantee that DCS will have more resources to deliver on a plan if it's stipulated in regulations rather than in the current wording in the Act within available resources. The position is acknowledged, as I've said previously, by the Constitution, whereby government must progressively realize socioeconomic rights within its available resources. And then the ISS made a similar submission, as well as from the Parliamentary Research Unit, which raised concerns that the provision does not create an obligation for the National Commissioner. I think the similar before comments from the members, maybe I must say, that similar comments are made throughout all of these vulnerable groups, because in each instance we're not creating an obligation for DCS, because it would be impossible to create, at this stage, to roll out a plan in the country where we treat vulnerable groups in each and every center in a similar manner. We're trying to create centers where there will be such facilities. So if somebody is admitted with a disability, the idea would be to place a person within that district in that facility. But we can't say all 240 centers will immediately cater for people with disabilities or the aged or mentally ill, which we will come to. So that's just from the outset a comment to be made.
Yes, Mr. Max?
Chairperson, I just want to make a comment, not really on this particular issue, but the wording which you use here, within available resources. I think that is also applicable to the clothing, you know, and if the circumstances dictate or whatever, and at the discretion maybe of the National Commissioner, depending on the circumstances, then if that must is going to bind you, you know, to rephrase that particular act to read similar. Because this is a phase we should go in, and as you explained now, very short explanation, there are certain circumstances which prompt you to place people in uniform. But just to rephrase, and maybe the wording changed. Thanks. Just a remark.
Chairperson, the problem here is that who determines whether the resources are available or not? The powers that be. will determine whether they have the resources in order to provide a particular service or not. And that, to my mind, Chairperson, is something that's very, very wide. It's actually an escape clause. In short, Chairperson, it actually means that at any given time, the answer will be, well, we don't have the resources, we can't make it available. Now, we've got to balance that against the human rights. So I don't know whether the department still wants to give thought to this, but this, to my mind, Chairperson, leaves it too wide, and it's a form of saying that, listen, we are unable to do it. We hide behind this little clause, subject to available resources. I'm just making this point, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Ms. Lowe, if I could just get some clarification on the use of the word may.
No, I know that that's not a member of the committee, but it is CSIPR, isn't it? Ms. Ballard, a stakeholder. Let me allow her to raise the question, Ms. Ballard, and I'll make a ruling whether you should answer it or not. Is that okay?
Thanks.
Continue, ma'am.
Thanks, Chair. Ms. Lowe, if I could just get some clarification about the use of the word may in conjunction within available resources. I mean, with any socioeconomic right, the phrase within available resources is always a constitutional limit on its fulfillment. So presumably, if there are available resources, then a certain function must be fulfilled. Can you perhaps clarify why there is still necessarily a discretion evident in the word may?
You're hearing, I don't need you to answer anyone specifically, but I think the point that we are making, first of all, Mr. Abram, our understanding of when it says the department, law says that it's the accounting officer. So everybody will do it, but ultimately the national commissioner. If anybody could prove that there was and the department didn't do it, the head of the national commissioner is on the block, as we understand it. But I think you're hearing what we're saying, and I hear your point that, and let me check to see that I understood it. I think you said in Section 12 or in a previous one, you must supply basic health services, you must supply certain things. This is over and above what you must supply. Resources allowing, you would then do X, Y, and Z. I'm saying that's what you're basically saying in layman's language, that there would be a basic health provision, and there would be these, if resources are allowing. Initially, let's be honest, initially all of us, because we didn't have that understanding. Myself, on all from 49DE, on all where you had may, I had highlighted, and I said you must put must, because I had not read it in conjunction with the previous one. I think you should, and we would also apply our mind, is there another way of saying what you're saying, Lorette, that it's an ideal to which we want to strive, as opposed to say, if you say, I must, it's just not going to be implementable because we don't have that ability in all 249 facilities. But it's an ideal to which we are striving. I don't know that... we could find a phrase to do that. I'm just saying that if you had put that thing, it would help us. And also, with that understanding that Clause 12 demands that you do certain basic things, I think helps us. We'd have to sell it also, and I think I need to, and I'm saying we will still debate it, but I concur, Mr. Max, for instance, that we can't tie the department down currently. Because if we do that, there would be litigation and challenges every day of the week in all our facilities. But what we should be doing is saying the spirit and the letter is that we're moving in that direction, and we will press as far as possible to move in that direction. I think that is the tactical reality.
and we'd have to sell it that way. So I don't know that, but I think the point that we're making is that, that you would have to go and apply your mind. We would argue about it in terms of the constitutional demand and so on. If we satisfy that we meet the constitutional requirements in Section 12, or what that 12 that you were talking about, it's fine, and this is over and above that. And it's, in other words, if it's possible, and we can prove it, Commissioner, that there's Vincent in a wheelchair in cell A, and ideally you should have been taking him to cell C, or just with a little bit of an adjustment, he should be in cell C, we would certainly wrap you around the knuckles if you do it, or if you don't do it from a vengeance point of view. I'm saying we must be able to move in that direction. I would argue that we should not put it into legislation as must. I think it's just going to be a problem. But we would have to find a way of continuously encouraging you to move in that direction. I know that you said earlier on the Constitution's intention is that we will do it incrementally. But that incrementally must be as short as possible in terms of reaching that point. We can't hide behind increment. 16 months, 16 years down the line, quite honestly, I'm unable to go and explain to my constituency. I can't. So I have a pressure as a public representative, and that pressure will be transferred to yourself. So whilst it's welcome, you must understand the pressures that, that MPs will have. And I'm sure when we take it through the House, those that have not been party to these discussions will raise it in the debate. That you can't tell us 16 years down the line that you still don't have these facilities. It's our responsibility to explain that the intention is to move in that direction. We will further process it if we think that there's a way of taking away the laxity of it and propose it and bring it to the table, but we ask you to do the same thing. Just to allay the fears of the committee and the public at the end of the day that it's not a... if I'm in a good mood, I'll do it. If I'm not in a good mood, I'll hide behind something else type of thing. But yes, Mike.
I think, Chair, I think we do accept what you're saying, and it is important for us to move forward. The concerns of the members are understandable equally. But I think what we need to understand is where we come from. We are coming from a situation where in the previous act, this was not provided for at all. And I think what we seek to do now is to create impetus in law that there must be recognition of the fact that there are vulnerable groups and they need to be catered for. And that is the step that we are moving from. From initially nothing, and where we say we recognize that there are certain vulnerable groups that cannot only be catered for by just providing basic medical care. But insofar as you recognize that and bring it into law with an impetus into law, you also do not want to be impractical about the way in which you are going to implement it. So I think the intention is to say that the manner in which correctional services works must be in such a way that we recognize the special needs of vulnerable groups. And this is the intention of putting it in law, where in the initial instance it was not there. But as to deal with the issue of within the availability of resources and the limitation thereof, this is not something specific to correctional services. It is not specific to the provision of these services. I think, as the writer was saying, it is a matter that is there in the Constitution that recognizes the fact that when you provide this the practical expression of this right is limited to the availability of these resources in any one of them, whether it be housing and so on and so on. So I think that is just to recognize that. And there's a rationale why those who drafted the Constitution have put that in terms of the intention of the law, so that what you put there does not, at the end of the day, defeat the actual intentions that you have read initially. So I don't think the point of putting that qualification is to run away from the responsibility. I think we need to recognize that the intention of putting the clause is to recognize that this needs impetus in law. And I think if we recognize it this way, I think we'll see it in a positive way than if we if we see it as running away from the responsibility. I think that is the point that I wanted to make.
That's right. That's right. We will process it as committee and see if we can improve it. You want to carry on, ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. If I could then move on to Section 49C, and again, I think it's the similar, it's this exactly the same recommendation or submission made there. Then 49D, which deals with mentally ill, here I would like to go into a bit more detail. As you can see, we provide more detailed response as well. CGE submitted that they could not support subsection 3 in its current format because the DCS might fail to provide the requisite standard of support and therefore proposed amending the subsection from may to must. Again, it's similar. Subsection 3 deals with, as far as practical, provide social and psychological services in order to support mentally ill remand in their needs and promote their mental health. I seem to be missing... I don't know where the other comments on it is. I think a lot of comments that were submitted to us on mentally ill refer to the fact that the department should not be housing mentally ill at all. Yes, it refers to the comments, and that's where my response comes in. CSPRI, which draws the attention of the committee to rules 82 and 83 of the UN minimum standard for the treatment of prisoners, but requires mentally ill persons to be detained in suitable medical facilities and not prisons. I think my response here, to give context to this new provision on mentally ill remand detainees, is the fact that who do we have as remand detainees? We have to understand who we mean when we refer to mentally ill. We were trying here not only for those who are sent to us in terms of a warrant under Section 77 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Those are the people who say, well, I heard voices which instructed me to go and kill somebody. They get sent for mental observation by a judge or a magistrate to base copies wherever, but they wait very long periods sometimes in our centers for bed space. That's one category of remand detainees that we have in our centers. Another category, which the ministerial task team found within our centers, is if you enter a center and you ask, where do you keep people with mental problems, they would point out to a cell. And in that cell, you might have people who have been sent there in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, but you also have people who are not, they're not questioning the fact that they can stand trial and accept responsibility for their actions. The magistrate has not ordered them to, for observation in terms of Section 77, but they have real problems. It might be because of abuse of tick. We had an example here in Portsmouth where I know two judges, from the one from the Constitutional Court actually visited, and from the local courts, which brought it to our attention, and our own task team found the gentleman there who was chained to a bed day and night because of tick withdrawal symptoms, and he had real mental problems, but he fell through the cracks currently because he doesn't await bed space anywhere. We cannot place him in terms of Section 50, which I must explain as well. Section 50 of the Mental Health Care Act, which says that sentenced inmates with mental problems can be, our head of the correctional center can apply, and they go for psychological analysis, and then the magistrate will order he must stay at this psychiatric hospital. That's only for sentenced. We're talking here about remand detainees. So the only categories of remand detainees that we have in terms of law at the moment is the one sent for observation. But in practice, in reality, we have other people. So currently we're acknowledging that this, the way it was written here or draft subsection 1 doesn't make it clear enough who we're talking about. So we're proposing amending it with the words that you can see on page 19 of the submission, where we're saying, in order to clarify this provision, we're saying the National Commissioner may detain a person suspected to be mentally ill in terms of, and we add this in, Section 71 of the Criminal Procedure Act, or a person experiencing mental health care problems in a single cell or hospital section for purposes of observation by a medical practitioner. So we're opening it up to a category which currently does not receive any attention by any legislation. where our people who actually manage this correctional facility can see this person is a real problem, and we're currently placing them in cells with other people, but we're not necessarily in law creating any rights or any provisions where we can cater for them. I just also have an anecdote there. For instance, the United Nations Handbook on Prisoners with Special Needs points out that 50 to 80% of prisoners have some form of mental disability. And clearly, if this should be the case in South Africa, the Department of Health cannot cope with those numbers. So it doesn't help just looking at their legislation to place over remand detainees. It's how do we deal with people with real mental problems currently in our system? So that's just to clarify what we meant with mentally ill. And we're now trying to clarify by amending that definition. So it's clear we're talking about people referred to us in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act as well as this other category, which currently they're fit to stand trial, but they do have real problems that we need to attend to.
That is just the question, specifically the mentally ill. Is it also wishful thinking or unachievable if we said mentally ill people must at least be kept in single cells? Is that an unachievable thing? I feel strongly about this one. And I suppose we would, and I'm not talking about those that the magistrate will say, send him to stare contained for 3 months to find out if when he committed this thing, sort of like that. But you get somebody who's been there before, for instance, got bipolar or whatever, been there, come out, because they go there for a certain period to stare contained, come back, goes home, takes the TV from home because these things are informed led by the use of drugs and so on, using bipolar and so on. So takes the TV from home, his mother catches him, slaps her, she dies, or something like that. So this chap has a problem. He's bipolar, or he's, with all due respect, mad, if I can put it in commas, but it was induced by the use of drugs, and comes out, and because he's now craving for drugs, does something and must go because he's committed a crime. Those guys, or that type of, that category of remand detainee, is it not a danger to him or her if they put into, especially the reality is that we have overcrowded cells wherever we are. Now the question that I'm raising, just from a practical point of view, is it possible to have those type of individuals, for instance? And I would assume it would be the same with the, well, let me put it different. I'm using that as an example. Is it possible to have severe cases of people with disability of whatever nature put into single cells as far as is humanly possible? Is that possible? I think that is going to help us sell some of these type of things. And I know it might not be possible if in some, for instance, if in the police facilities, it probably wouldn't be possible. But what is your take on those type of things? I mean, do we try as that as a first priority, or do we say, well, look, he's going to have to go where everybody else is? Because once we understand what the department's current thinking is, we'd be able to convince each other. I was using the bipolar just as an example. What is the current thinking? You know, our fear, to be quite honest with you, is that sometimes you get a sense that regardless of whether you're a child, whether you are mentally unstable, whether you are going to be targeted because you've got lots of money, or you are your sexual orientation might be different. The current sense that we get is that regardless of all those things, everybody gets put into a cell, and then it's a free-for-all, and only the strongest survive. I'm saying that's the impression that the committee and South Africans have generally. Your intention here is to say that, look, let's try and address that type of thing. Here. But are there areas where we can say we would, the immediate effect will address this one and that one and that one? I mean, we have, is it in Kimberley, where we have some famous male, I shouldn't say famous, but well-known male inmate that goes by a female name? You remember? No, it wasn't there. It was somewhere in Bloemfontein. Huh? Is it for, somewhere. Now, I'm using that as an example. This individual
dresses like a woman, looks like a... It's, I don't know where we are, but let me use it as... But this is one individual that, just by his choice, is going to be vulnerable by going into that set. Do you guys then sit and look at that and say, look, we have to make an exception of this individual, or do you just throw them into the cell? I think that's the sentiment we'd want to get from you, because depending on what you answer, we'd be able to convince each other whether we'll stick by must or may, or whether we agree that we're moving in that direction. These are the real practical experiences that we pick up on the ground. What is your take as a department on those type of things? Yes, sir.
You know, I think it will be just appropriate to tell us what are they doing currently with the social situation, and we can see.
You see, Chair, the problem is that this legislation, once enacted, will not be amended for a long time to come. Our recent history proves that. So we've got to be so careful that whatever legislation we enact must be legislation that can be lived with, that is implementable, that is, shall I call, user-friendly for the next, say, minimum 20, 25 years. Now, bearing that in mind, Chair, if you look at the wording of, for example, 49D2, what it says here, on the one hand, it says the department must provide, but then, of course, as a qualification, within its available resources. Now, Chairperson, on the one hand, we say that it must provide. On the other hand, there's a qualification. Now, it's very simple if this becomes law. For the person on whose desk a request comes to decide on a particular issue, to turn back and say, yeah, but although the law says that we must provide, it's within available resources, and we don't have the resources. So we need to bear that in mind, and we're asking the department here that they need to come up with a solution. We realize that our resources are limited. But we must also realize that, as I said earlier, legislation, once enacted, does not get amended in a hurry. I mean, it's not a question of, once this is enacted as it stands, that in a year or two, we find that, listen, man, here is a problem. We've got to amend it. We know that it's a tedious process. So, Chair, I'm asking that we need to word these clauses in such a way that they will live for another decade or two. Thank you, Chair.
I certainly agree with Honorable Abrams that we should not write the law in such a way that it creates impediment for achieving the objectives that we want to achieve. But I must also add that that's not what we're trying to do. Because if it were to happen, that because the resources are discussed here as well. I mean, we come to this house to come and motivate for voting of funds and for justification of our priorities. And this house, as the custodian of the aspirations of people, is always able to say, we do not think that is where you should be putting your resources. We think you need to be putting here because you've got a legal mandate to do the following things in terms of the law that we enacted here. So that will always remain. But I think the issue that we're raising is that the intention of the law must also not become a stumbling block to the effective way of planning and all that. I think that if we can recognize the need to
to do certain things from a policy and principle point of view, and then be able to say that in terms of privatization, when the funds are available, those things should be done. We will be acting in recognition of our real practical circumstances. But if we can just write here that everything must and must and must and must, we'll find ourselves in a situation where we've created a law which ourselves are not going to be capable of implementing. And I was making an example that the Bill of Rights provides for many rights. And those rights sometimes, and depending on the circumstances, get limited on the basis of whether we're able to achieve them or not. But the commitment must remain, and that is why we don't just want some of those rights to remain in the Bill of Rights, but to be enacted in the law, that the department must be committed towards achieving this right. And for all the things that we do, we'll always come back to this house and say, we think that we've budgeted one to buy so many cars this year, and the house can say, we think that with the available resources you have, your priorities must not lie with buying cars, because you've got a legal mandate to provide the following things, and we think that you are ready to be able to divert these resources, to utilize them for these purposes. But to come to the question that the chair was raising about vulnerable groups, we get questions from Parliament, for example, from honourable members about how many mentally ill patients do you have in your centre, and we get responses in terms of the definition that goes in terms of CPA, Criminal Procedures Act. The response that we receive from those who are dealing with these people on a day-to-day basis might say we've got 252 people, but that's in terms of a particular definition. But our experience was that, no, we moved in that center, and we moved in that center, and we moved in that center. The minister was there. In one center, we saw more than 100. How is it possible that nationally it can be 252? It was for this reason and many others that the minister set up the task team to go and audit certain categories of inmates. This included those who are vulnerable in terms of mental ill people, women with babies, pregnant women, and all that, as well as those who qualify for consideration for placement on parole, but have never been able to appear before a parole. So those categories, we needed to have the exact numbers on a headcount basis, and to interact with these people to understand what their circumstances and experiences are, and to go into the system and look at what is it that in the system is failing us to recognize some of the provisions of the law. The task team has now come out with a report. In fact, we received the presentation of their report yesterday. And the chair is saying, what is the thinking? And as we looked at this report, we realized that we've got a real problem with regard to these categories of mentally ill, some of them which are not being defined in our law or for purposes of the Criminal Procedures Act. And our thinking is that people who are like that need care, instead of what we are giving to them now. The fact that they've committed certain crimes does not change the reality that they need care. And together with the Department of Health, and in terms of the service delivery agreement that we have signed with the Department of Health, we want a situation where between the two departments, we can provide a high security care facility for those people, but that is an issue of a policy thinking, which we think that must be realized. It is a matter that between us and health we need to work out, and so, Chair, I do not want us to say we will resolve this problem through this legislation and this bill, but since you ask what the thinking is, that is our thinking. Our thinking with regard to people who are over the age of 65, the aged, and so on, who don't constitute a very big number in our facilities, but might be subject to abuse and all that, and might not have the same needs as some of the people who are still physically able and active, is that we need to separate them and deal with their cases differently. So there are all these things that we're discussing, but we're still very much at infant stage. We've just received a report that analyzes the trends and the circumstances of these various categories of vulnerable inmates in our centers. And the intention from the beginning has been to make sure that people who are vulnerable in our centers must be recognized, and their status must be recognized, and that they must be treated differently in terms of their various needs, which are not the same as those who you might call normal situation people. Thanks.
Now, I think we have a flavor of the disabled and those type of things enough for us to engage meaningfully when we do meet. So I think, Lorette, if there was anything around these special groups that you wanted to talk to, regardless of whether it has come from our stakeholders or not, I think as MPs we are reasonably fine. It's 12:45, 10:01 almost, and I have recognized that Advocate Smith and his team have arrived. You would recall, welcome, Advocate Smith. We received your apology and the reasons for arriving late, but you also would recall that when we departed on Tuesday, we indicated that together with the department, you should come, or co-authors should come and explain to us the reason why these things were so different. Cindy informed me earlier on that she had received a call from you indicating that you would withdraw. I made that announcement, withdraw the presentation, of the prosecuting authority. We made that announcement. We also thought that it was prudent, sir, that for the record, the commissioner also raised his things, but I think for the record we'd allow you an opportunity to talk to this matter. We have asked the department and members to continue with matters that we thought were relevant that came out of that presentation. So in other words, it's not been thrown out holus bolus, but there were matters that we thought we would deal with that are relevant. But I think just for recording purposes, can we afford you an opportunity to talk to the matter, because the commissioner has, and if you want to add, commissioner, you could, and then we'll break for lunch and then continue with the business later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, might I take the opportunity of introducing one of the new Deputy National Directors who is also in Cape Town with us, Nomvula, to the committee. She'll also address this particular matter in person. I also have my colleague, Advocate Makoti, who was down at the previous occasion.
Good afternoon. Yes, that is the position, Mr. Chair. You got it right. And I'm here as a courtesy call, and also to say to this House, and as well as to you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner there, that we regret the effects of the submissions that we have made insofar as they relate to policy issues. And we do understand that there are certain processes that have to be followed before we can make submissions in that regard. Hence the withdrawal, Mr. Chairperson. And insofar as the rest of the submissions, we have had discussions with the representatives of the Department of Correctional Services, and we have come to an agreement, and they actually know what I'm going to be saying now. This is an edited utterance, which we agreed on earlier on, from yesterday up until today, Mr. Chairperson. And from now on, we will not be engaging in any further debate. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me reiterate, Mr. Abram, you are not here. We have said that some of the points raised by that presentation are valid, like cost to uniforms and those type of things, which we are not going to limit any MP from discussing. But the presentation as a presentation from the organization will then be withdrawn, and Cindy would note it accordingly, because we would be able to say these were the institutions that did presentations to us, and it's on those bases that we can justify interacting with the public. But it doesn't take away from whatever we'd want to raise Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you. I don't know, Advocate Smith, if you still want to add, or Commissioner, but we are comfortable with it. Our concern just was that it makes life very difficult for the legislature when the executive don't seem to be talking the same language, because we don't know how to handle it. But I think from our side, now that you've raised it, we accept it as it is, and we'll continue with business. It doesn't have a major impact on our processing of the bill. So thank you very much to you. Thank you very much, Advocate, and to your colleague that was with you.
Advocate Makroti.
Advocate Makroti, yes. Thank you very much. Yuki, you're welcome to join us. We had indicated that we're going to lunch. We're having interesting discussions and debates so that we just get more clarity. We are going to break for lunch. Can we agree, Cindy, the boss around here, that we have a 45-minute lunch? We really want to leave early. Everybody that is here, if we could be back at about, what, 1:30? If we could be back at 1:30, even if it means you come in with your plate, we're not providing lunch, just so that we work through these things. It's very useful for us, and it's going to make life easier on the 12th. We have not provided lunch, I don't think. There is food on the second floor, I suppose, Cindy, or is that only for MPs? Only for members? Not for your own pocket, absolutely, yes. For your own pocket, but 90 Plain Street, no, I'm sure. Do you have to make provisions upstairs? Those that want to eat upstairs, I'll be nice to all of you, it's fine. Those that want to eat upstairs, if we have a table, we can all sit together and talk about pirates and chiefs. As long as you support pirates, it's fine. Those that want to go and have their own one will go and have their own one. I'm sure we'd be able to sneak you in. I think many people would have left today. But there is a canteen on the second floor. There's a canteen in 90 Plain Street. There's takeaways across the road. But those that want to eat with me on the second floor, never going to happen again. Follow me and we can eat at the second floor. And we're back at 1:30, 1:45 at the absolute latest.